Good morning. How are you, Corey?
Our March 8th meeting will please come to order. Members, a word about later today. If necessary, we will reconvene at 6:30 here in the basement to resume our hearing. That's if needed.
I'm doing everything I can to make it.
Would the legislative assistant please note the roll? And Representative Myra, would you move the minutes, please? Representative Myra moves the minutes of March 6th. Please look them over, members. Are there any corrections or additions? Hearing none and seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 6th are approved. Members, today we have three bills on the agenda. The first is one that we're taking from having been laying over, the Davney provision, HF 2293. Representative Davney, would you like to go to the testifying table? And members, what you should find at your places is an H2293 UE1 document, and that is the document that we'll be working from. We did move this bill previously, so 2293 now has been amended to become this document, the UE1 document. And Representative Davney, I believe you have an amendment to add to that, correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Good morning. In their packets, members should find the H2293A6 amendment. I'd like to move that to be before
Representative
the
Davney moves the H2293A6 amendment. Representative Davney, just briefly explain your amendment, and then we'll act on it.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment is a product of a cast of thousands that Ms. Abderholden from NAMI convened, advocates, the departments, the Disability Law, Minnesota Disability Law Center, a broad range of people with concerns on this issue. A couple of things to note. The language is intended to move us forward in getting to a point of reducing the use of prone restraints. And members will note on page 1, line 6, broadly reduce the use of restrictive procedures. So broader than just prone restraints. And one of the underlying parts of the discussion that Ms. Abderholden drew together was we can't do this without data, that the data will allow school districts and the department to work together in reducing the use of all restrictive procedures. And that is the goal of the statewide plan that the amendment directs the department to develop with a broad array of stakeholders involved.
Thank you very much, Representative Davney, for doing your homework and doing it in such a timely fashion and in a consensus nature. All those in favor of the A6 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and we have the A6 amendment now as part of the UEI document. Do you have any testifiers, Representative Davney?
Madam Chair, I do not. My understanding also is that the ARC, while still having a goal of eliminating prone restraints, is not in opposition to this bill any longer, and the Minnesota Disability Law Center has said that they will not are not interested in testifying this morning, that it would be redundant on their previous testimony. Their concerns remain, but they were present and part of the consensus process has developed the amendment we just adopted.
And does the department have any statement on this? My question would be, will we receive the February 1 report? Or the plan, actually, if the department would just, for the record, indicate whether or not that'll be coming to the legislature, because the report is to be in place by February 1, 2013. Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, Kevin McHenry, Department of Education. Just want to reiterate thanks Representative Davney and everybody else who worked on this. This is a bill that we are supporting. And as far as the report, yeah, that is something that will be submitted to the legislature again, just as it did this past session.
Thank you very much, Mr. McHenry. So if there are no questions, members, are there any questions? Seeing no questions, then I'll renew Representative Davidy's motion that House File 2293, as amended, be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and this bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you very much, Representative Davidy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Members, the next bill on the agenda has no author present yet, but it will be the House File 2621, Mayoral Control. So would you take just a few minutes to look over the DE3 amendment? This bill will be moving to government operations, but if you would look that over before Representative Kelly makes an appearance, which I hope is very shortly. And he is presenting apparently in another committee. So members, I did a little reading on mayoral control. In Minneapolis, mayoral control ended in 1959. What I found interesting is that in the last 20 years, Minneapolis has had 15 superintendents. And among those 15, seven interim superintendents. In St. Paul, mayoral control ended in 1946. Actually, there was a strike by some interesting female-led, a female teacher who had to be elderly when she became very active in this move to improve the buildings in St. Paul, because the argument was that the city of St. Paul was spending much more money on a government, because this was a relationship between the city of St. Paul and the schools, but they were spending more money on enhancing their government services than they were on their school buildings, and their school buildings were becoming dilapidated, and I in the reading I did, it seemed like they were even unhealthy. So the mayoral control ended in 1946. The teacher strike was about a month long, and our late and former Governor Elmer Anderson, who served in the legislature at the time, introduced a bill in the House where he served to allow school districts to be a school district to be formed in St. Paul. So if you want to go to the reference library and do a little reading, this is rather interesting how this played out. So I suppose I could start maybe walking through. No, let me give you a little bit more history of St. Paul. In 1912, I better get all my reading out here. I did all this last night and found this to be very interesting. 1847, St. Paul's earliest teacher of note, Miss Harriet Bishop, launched a school near what is now Kellogg and St. Peter. In 1848, the next year, she moved her private school to a new building. It was 25 by 30, and it cost $300 to construct. In 1856, St. Paul's first school board consisted of 9 elected and 2 ex officio members after the legislature passed a special charter creating a board of education. A man named Edward Dufield Neal of the 3rd Ward was elected as the first secretary and later became the school district's first superintendent. In 1865, 10 years later, 16 teachers were employed by the St. Paul schools, 3 males, 13 females, including 5 assistants. The number of male to female students was 1,124 to 987. In 1866, there were no educational opportunities for students after grade school. So in 1870, 2 students, a Fannie Hayes and an A.P. Warren, became the first 2 students to graduate from a St. Paul High School, which became Central. In 1872, St. Paul's mayor was an ex officio member of the school board. In 1874, the power was given to the school board to purchase sites. Now remember, this is still under the governance of St. Paul, though. Power was given to the school board to purchase sites, build schools, and operate the schools within the limits of a 10-mill levy on the assessed value of the property of the city. In 1879, St. Paul High School had 8 teachers and a principal, and this high school, as I said earlier, became Central High School. In 1887, just about 10 years later, the school board no longer was elected but appointed by the mayor, and it was a 2-year term. The board had full power to control all matters related to school books, appointments, and educational programs in general. In 1891, the law limited the school board's power. So you think we have issues today? 1897, Grover Cleveland High School opened. It is now, or was, renamed Johnson High School in 1911. In 1900, Home Rule Charter provided an increase in the tax rate for school purposes. The Common Council thereupon promptly raised the appropriation so that in 1901, the board was enabled to expend $615,770 instead of $443,540 that had been expended during 1900. And for 1907, the appropriation was fixed at $772,600. Between 1902 and 1910, the commission form of government gained momentum. In 1906, there were 27,940 students attending St. Paul Public Schools. In 1909, Humboldt Senior High was built, and in 1981, the school added ninth grade, becoming then a 4-year high school. In 1912, the school board was abolished in favor of a commissioner of education, one of 6 commissioners in St. Paul's newly established commission form of government. In 1914, St. Paul City government seized power of all school matters, equivalent to the school board. In 1915, Mrs. R.A. Lee, first woman as president of Randolph Heights Parent-Teacher Association, formerly known as Mother's Club. 1923, Randolph Heights School Library branch had a circulation of 13,000 volumes. 1933, the 8th grade class of 1933 at Douglas Elementary had a famous photograph taken. In 1940, there were 12,684 students enrolled in St. Paul's schools. So that was a drop in enrollment. And I think most of you know that private schools in St. Paul were extremely popular. And as the public school buildings became more dilapidated, parents sent their children to private schools. 1946, the first St. Paul public school teacher strike. And the Girls Vocational Senior High School was established with Miss Agnes Larson as principal. In 1950, St. Paul Public Schools Board of Education reestablished again after years of intense campaigning by civic-minded citizens. 1954, the United States Supreme Court ruling that public education between minority groups and the majority could not be equal if it remained separate. And welcome to our committee, Representative Kelly. I will move the House File 2621 to be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Kelly, I believe you also have a delete everything amendment, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And I will move for Representative Kelly the H2621 DE3 amendment. Representative Kelly, will you explain your amendment, please?
Yes, and my apologies, Madam Chair, just presenting a different bill. So,
oh, Representative Kelly, I had fun just going through the timeline of St. Paul's schools, and I could have gotten to Minneapolis. So thank you very much for being able to put up with my timeline.
Madam Chair,
Representative O'Driscoll.
Representative Kelly, I think you also saved us from a quiz later on in the discussions as well. So thank you.
Representative Kelly, again, welcome, and please explain your DE3 amendment.
Well, Madam Chair and members, the DE3 amendment
was the result of a lot of conversation and in looking at the mural control issue, it was determined that the only way this is going to work, we want it to be a tool for the betterment of the districts of Minneapolis and St. Paul. But in order for it to work, the mayor definitely has to be on board. And so we did not want to be heavy-handed here and make this a mandate, but instead make it permissive, so that if the mayor in his or her position feels that it's appropriate to step forward and take control of the district, that they would be allowed to do so. So that's really what the Delete All Three amendment did.
So, members, to get this in the order that the author would like it, let's vote on the DE3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the DE3 amendment is adopted. Representative Kelly, do you have testifiers?
I think there's plenty of testifiers, Madam Chair. I think a lot of people have some concerns about it, would like the conversation with it, and I certainly welcome that. So I guess initially I'd just like to proceed with maybe a little bit more of the description of the bill so that
thank you.
So
yes.
That we can set
walk us through the bill, everyone. We are dealing with the DE3 amendment now to House File 2621. Thank you.
All right. Initially, the bill just speaks to Minneapolis and St. Paul, as it says, the city with more than 250,000 residents located in the seven county metropolitan area. So that does speak to Minneapolis and St. Paul. The option would be for the mayor to step in, as I said, permissive language, because if they saw that they wanted to do this, this gives them the ability to, by submitting to the Department of Education a plan, they would need to make sure that the intent was stated. I think we have a September 1st deadline for them to state that they would be taking over the plan, but then they would have to submit a plan to the department. And this plan is not for the department to approve or not. It just says that we have a plan going forward. And from a control standpoint, the mayor would be able to appoint the CEO or superintendent. They would also be able to appoint the school board. And the appointments are appointments at will. And one of the main reasons for this, there's a number of studies done, but probably the most noted ones is the Itasca group and the Rutgers study, which I won't go into all the detail until we have some more of the testifiers come through and have that discussion. But just from a control standpoint, that's how the mayor would gain control. And one of the leading factors there is just creating stability. And I've heard from many people involved in education, both in St. Paul and Minneapolis. I believe they certainly feel there's good things happening, which I would assume they should feel that way. But from the standpoint of where we're at and where we're headed, there has certainly been concern, as we've talked about in Ed Finance Long, I'm sure that you've talked about here, Madam Chair. So the impetus here is to put another tool in the toolbox to say, have we really looked at all the opportunities out there? The language is also patterned after several other cities who have done this, most notably Chicago and Boston, along with New York, who have considered a strong mayoral control system. And again, Madam Chair, we'll have more of that discussion, but the duties of the mayor certainly will be, from an accountability standpoint, is the performance of the school districts. And from that standpoint, what we've seen, even with some of our reform languages and things that we've all agreed upon here, is that when we see people accountable, we tend to get higher performance. And this is, in my opinion, the ultimate of accountability, where we have a focal point right at the top of the highest office in the cities. And Mayor, with that, I think I'll pause and let's have other conversation and testimony.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question.
Representative Kelly, are there any co-authors who represent either the city of Minneapolis or St. Paul on your bill?
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, no, they're not.
Well,
Representative Benson.
Madam Chair, just a comment. It just seems that when we're having this kind of proposal, there ought to be people who represent the citizens of the communities that are going to be affected. This reminds me of outstate legislators, or at least those legislators outside Hennepin County, allowing the Hennepin County Board to tax property owners to build a twin stadium. And it just seems to me that if we believe in local government and decision making, at least we should have representatives from the cities that are going to be affected by such legislation.
Thank you, Representative Benson. I'm going to call to the table Jim Bartholomew. I believe you are here to testify in support of this proposal. Welcome to our table. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. We support House File 2621 and the conversation it creates about how to do better. It's important to say up front that our support for this bill is based on concerns about long-term trends in student performance, and it is not meant as a criticism of any particular individuals or group. To summarize why we're concerned about student performance in Minneapolis and St. Paul, I'll just highlight the four-year high school graduation rates. The statewide rate is 76%, a level that needs to improve. However, for St. Paul, the rate is 63%, and in Minneapolis, it's 49%. For Hispanic and African American students in Minneapolis, the rates are 36 and 39% respectively. Passing House File 2621 and creating the opportunity for the mayor of Minneapolis or St. Paul to assume a more substantial role in governing their school districts won't instantly change overall performance, but it can create a new set of dynamics that will lead to improvements. Based on available research, some of the benefits of moving to a mayoral system of school governance include a more focused line of accountability, greater stability and leadership, and improved coordination of school, city, and community resources. In the case of accountability for decisions and results, most people can tell you who the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul are. By contrast, almost no one could name the respective school board members. House File 2621 would create a singular place for people to go if they have ideas or issues regarding the district. The tenure of mayors, and thereby the terms of their appointees, also tend to be longer than school board majorities and superintendents. Counting Superintendent Carol Johnson, Minneapolis has had five people serve as superintendent since 2002. Having a degree of stability allows one set of reforms to take root and have an impact. Mayoral governance also enhances the ability to coordinate city-community resources. Not only is a mayor more directly engaged in district operations, but they're also directly in position to align city resources. Mayors also have broader connections throughout the cities with employers, foundations, and nonprofits. These connections can be used to provide greater support for our schools. There are, and have been, efforts to build community support around our schools. And while some of these have been successful, as a whole, they've not met expectations, in part because there is no one person in charge. Given the long-term trends in student performance in our two core cities, we support House File 2621 as a means of creating a new set of dynamics that will change the status quo and lead to improved results for our students. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Representative Mariani?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick questions. Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew, for your testimony. One, I actually have some some strong empathy on the issue of stability for all our political institutions, but particularly for our schools and certainly in superintendents. And this is an area that does concern me. I'm wondering, though, short of doing this bill, it seems to me that there may be some other ways in which we can try to build longer-term stability for our superintendents. Is that something that the business partnership has looked at in terms of a different way to provide longer-term stability? And if we were able to do that, would it make the business partnership support for this bill moot?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, not aware of alternatives to, you know, superintendents being selected by a majority of school board members or a mayoral governance system, but we'd certainly be open to alternatives.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. And actually, I haven't done all the research myself, but my understanding is that there is state statute that does limit the time in which superintendents the time that they would have under a current contract. And it seems to me that perhaps one of the things we could look at, Madam Chair, might be if, in fact, that is a state bar in statute, and I don't know why we would have one, that perhaps that might be a much more easier approach than approach here that opens up a whole bunch of other issues. And so maybe that's something we can all work together at some point. And then my other question is quite quick, simply is, you know, sort of the big question. Representative Benson touched on it. You know, Representative Kelly, you know, it's the issue of why two school districts when we have, I don't know, 300-something school districts across the state in which achievement gaps are pretty common, whether it's, you know, down in Worthington or out in some of our second suburban communities. I don't have the statistics before me, but I suspect that in many of those districts, you've got some pretty rivaling outcomes relative to even just the issue of high school graduation. So it seems to me that if it's important for that to be addressed via this mechanism, then why would the, well, maybe the question for the business partnership would be, would the business partnership support a similar approach as in this bill relative to all those other districts that have similar educational outcomes that you're concerned with?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I think we'd be open to that as well. Our prime concern is that, and it's a very complex issue, and we've talked about this over the years, but I think that this bill addresses a rather urgent need in two specific districts where the trends have been rather long-term, and a number of things have tried to address the situation, and yet the trends persist. So, but we'd be open to that in other places as well.
Madam Chair,
Representative Mariani,
this will be my final quick comment. I think that that's really the only position the business partnership could take. If it's going to be a position based on integrity, that if there's concern for the student outcomes based on a historical pattern, you and I, we know the data. We sit down together sometimes. You have similar data over time all across the state. And I can't think why, if this is a good idea for two school districts, why it wouldn't be a good idea for 3 or 10 or 20 or 50 or all of them. And I think, Representative Kelly, that's an important question, if you're going to pursue this bill, to answer if the bill is going to have any kind of integrity in the legislature.
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, I think since we went there, one of the main reasons this bill has risen to this point, this isn't a new issue as well. In fact, just in 2010, Governor Pawlenty presented this as well as an option that we should be looking at, and it really has to do with data. This isn't just to say we want the districts of Minneapolis-St. Paul to be taken over by the mayor for any particular reason other than creating a different look, a different opportunity to do better, because we trail across from state averages. The districts themselves trail by close to 20 points percentage-wise in reading assessment, math assessment, and science assessment. So this isn't for any other reason than we're trying to look at other ways of teaching our children. I think what we've shown over the years, and again, it's not a 1 year time period. This is historical data that has been significant for very long. I've said from the start, even my experience in the school board, the one thing that hurts us is turnover. And we don't get the change because we lack stability. Now, I had a great conversation just the other day with the chair of the St. Paul School Board, and I think from the way they laid things out, and I think we'll hear from them today, is that they do feel that they're making some very important strides, and from they have improved some of their proficiency measures, but they're measuring from where they are to where they're going, and I applaud those efforts. If as the mayor of St. Paul, I'd be looking at that and saying, well, if that's where we're going and what we're doing, maybe that's the stability I want. Right now, we don't have that ability, but we're certainly looking at this because of the data that's out there.
You know, and members, keep in mind that Arne Duncan, our Secretary of Education, did oversee the Chicago schools for 7 years. Before he was appointed Secretary of Education, he was appointed by the mayor, and I have heard him speak about this, and I know that he considers it as one option, but we should have a very good conversation. Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, I had two questions for Mr. Bartholomew.
Go ahead.
Return.
Oh, Mr. Bartholomew, you can't run away.
No.
Sorry.
Not letting you get away that easily.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bartholomew, you stated in your testimony that no one knows who the school board members are in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I'm wondering what survey data you have to underlie that conjecture.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I don't have a specific survey, but other than anecdotal.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Mr. Bartholomew, thank you, because as you know, we've actually changed the governance structure of the Minneapolis schools to increase the transparency and accountability of the school board, going obviously in the opposite direction of Representative Kelly's bill, which clouds and decreases accountability and transparency. And so we're dealing with knitting the school district and the community closer together so that they can better build together stability, political base for reform, going the opposite direction, as I said, of Representative Kelly's bill. Madam Chair, Mr. Bartholomew, can you share with the committee your research on the correlation between governance structure and student achievement?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, overall, the change to a mayoral governance is a bit of a mixed bag in terms of student achievement. I think some of the districts that have shown the most promise would be Chicago, New York, Boston.
Washington, D.C.
And Washington as well. Those would probably be the best examples of where they've had long-term and impact on student achievement. But again, it is a mixed bag, and I think if anything from my testimony you should take from this is it creates an opportunity for change and improvement to occur, again, through some of the benefits of the we may disagree, but through the focused accountability, stability, and greater coordination of resources through the mayor's office.
Representative Dabney.
Well, Madam Chair, I can just share with the committee. I've spoken with researchers at the university on this very question of what is the correlation between governance structure and student achievement. And they've been very clear. There isn't any. You can have appointed school boards. You can have mayoral school districts. You can have three-member school boards, 5, 7, 9, 12. You have your governance structure for reasons other than student achievement because there's not a research-based correlation between the structure and student achievement. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Dabney. I would agree with you that a lot of the data that's out there suggests that it's inconclusive, but I would not agree. I mean, I'm not exactly sure which study were you quoting there, but actually the Itasca group was more of a qualitative study. The Rutgers group was more quantitative and actually does have data that shows from time period, for example, Boston and New York, from the time of takeover, that math assessment, English assessment, a quote from that was that that there have been citywide increases at all grade levels in the percentage of students achieving proficiency in advanced scores in the state's MCATs tests like we have here. So there I would agree on a broad basis. I would completely agree with you because that's what the study says. It's inconclusive, but the parts that are not inconclusive where they stated quite plainly is that the points that they agreed that there was agreement upon was the increased ability, actual increased funding from philanthropic organizations, private organizations, better community building. And so those are the things that are more qualitative, and I believe one of the reasons we don't have enough quantitative data is because in the current system, the oldest system is Boston in 1991. So mm-hmm. we're looking at this in a short time period in regard to historical, as Chair Erickson was going over the history of Minnesota itself. So I think that's part of the issue that we're dealing with.
Madam Representative Chair? Moran. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Bartholomew first.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, and that, just to build a little bit on that, and again, it's hard to tease out cause and effect of everything, but I would highlight the Council of Great City Schools did an analysis and released in November of 11, a study of 11 large urban districts on the NAEP assessments and their change in performance from 03 to 09, and Boston was one of the leading districts in terms of improved student achievement. Now, it's hard to say that that's all because of mayoral governance, but that certainly is in the mix.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kelly, can you tell me where the governors, the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul are with this bill?
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Moran, we have had conversations with the mayor's office. We invited them to engage in the conversation, and to date we have met personally with Mayor Coleman and his staff, and we've had conversations with Mayor Ryback.
Where are they with this bill?
Representative Moran. Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Moran, right now they state that they enjoy the conversation.
Mm. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you elaborate a little bit more when you talk about stability? What is that a factor on who have been stabilized with this type of initiative?
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, could you repeat that question, please?
In talking about stability, who has been stabilized?
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, a number of different items here. From the standpoint of stability, the mayor would be able to appoint a superintendent, CEO, as they call them in Chicago, and these employees are at will. So from a term standpoint, it would be similar to anyone operating in a management position, is that as long as they're doing the job, why wouldn't you keep in that position? The board appointees would operate the same way. And the stability there comes from in many of the districts that are in control of the mayoral from the mayor's office is what they found is actually longer collective bargaining agreements and less turnover from the standpoint of the CEO, the CFO, all the administrative staff. So that's the stability that has been achieved in many of the cities.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I heard you speak a little bit about transit, and I think that was students who are really transit in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Is that who you were speaking in reference to?
Mr. Bartholomew?
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, student mobility, is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
I don't know that mayoral, Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know that mayoral governance would necessarily address that problem, though I think arguably through the research it shows that the city and the district would probably be able to work in a better coordinated system to try and address certain, you know, whether it's transportation, you know, possibly housing, you know, at least you've got one governing authority that's involved with both of those, or those multiple issues, rather than schools over here and cities over here.
Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
And I ask these questions because we talk about stability, when we talk about transit, I'm not hearing the initial, what I thought I heard you say, this is about achieving better outcomes for kids. But I'm not hearing that in your presentation. I hear the stability is around superintendents, it's around a lot of other things, and not so much around children. We talk about being transit. We look at the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis, and we have a large population of kids, of families who are jobless, who are without jobs, who are homeless, who lack the support, they're in poverty, they lack opportunities. That creates for children and families to be more transit in the big cities. And so when I heard the testifier talk and presented his research-based evidence, none of that talked about creating better outcomes for children. And it's just really hard for me to see how we are giving so much governance to our mayors with less transparency, less engagement from the community, less opportunity. And I don't think at this time when we have such high numbers of disparities within our schools and high achievement gaps that we can have a mixed bag here. You know, you use the word mixed bag, or it could be evidence that is inconclusive. I don't think, not at this time, can we continue to introduce bills and policies that are so controversial, that does not have any evidence base or research base behind it. And it's the hope that we're going to create better outcomes for kids. Not at this time. This is a critical time. And
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Moran, just speaking specifically to the transient population, the studies did, actually the Itasca group did study that, and shows that mayoral effect or the school board governance has no effect on that. That's absolutely true. They have no control over the population movement, or it did not affect that. So that wasn't the point at all, and I wasn't making that the point. The point is how we're educating the children that are there, and how we're increasing their performance and getting better outcomes with possibly a different look, a different ability to bring new ideas and new governance in.
Representative Moran.
And that's all right, but there's no research or evidence base that says what you are presenting is going to create those outcomes for our kids. And I think we just have to look at the fact that we are in a crisis with our families, you know, where there are lacks of jobs. We have to have a holistic approach here, and just to continue to put authority in individuals' hands. And, I mean, really to bring a bill here to this committee with not one Minneapolis or St. Paul legislator who are supporting this bill, it's just a little far-fetched for others to assume that this is in without the support of the mayors of these cities. It's just a little lack of, you know, we hope that this will be better.
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair, just to be clear, the mayor's office have not been in support nor in opposition of this bill at this point.
And members, this is permissive language. Representative Woodard.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Dabney.
I'm disturbed that the author just misled the committee. And I feel like I do need, if you'll excuse me, Representative Woodard, to correct the record. Mayor Rybeck is opposed to this bill.
Representative,
there's a letter in our packets that's very clear. So I'm not sure, Representative Kelly, where your contention that he neither supports nor opposes this comes from when he, in fact, clearly states that he opposes it.
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, I would like you to read the statement in the letter that specifically says he opposes this legislation. He has concerns about it. He said he had concerns about being engaged in it, which is I'm a little disappointed in, because we have had the opportunity. We have reached out to both mayor's office. We have we did that before this was presented in difference to what the mayor suggested. So we have been engaged, and we have. I understand that at this point in time he believes that we should have this conversation, and he would like to be engaged more in the process, and I appreciate that. But nowhere in the letter does he say he opposes this legislation.
Well, Representative Kelly, I can assure you are misrepresenting the mayor's position. And while I find many of the issues that have been raised already by my colleagues disturbing, and I share them, I think having an author misrepresent support for his bill is deeply disturbing. And I thought below the ethics of this body. And below your previous behavior, Representative Kelly.
Kelly, you have met with staff, correct?
Madam Chair, and Kelly. Representative Dabney, I simply asked you to state where in his letter does he say he's opposed to this. I did not say he is in favor of this. I said that he had, just as his letter stated, that he has concerns about the process. He would like to be involved more in the process. We've reached out to staff on February 9th with emails. We've reached out to staff on February 28th. We've made the process clear of what was going on. Now, I did not, if you, Representative Dabney, believe that I suggested that Mayor Rybeck is in favor of this, I apologize for that, but I don't believe I stated that in any stretch. In fact, when Representative Moran asked me, I said they wanted the enjoyed the conversation. That was my specific words, I believe, to the committee.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm a little surprised by the dialogue we're having here, because I thought this would be a very good in-depth discussion about the benefits and the merits, or potentially the bad points of mayoral control. And I'm looking forward to kind of redirecting that conversation towards that. I certainly don't question your ethics, Representative Kelly. I read the letter. I certainly understand what you said about the mayor. Now, maybe, you know, there are others in the room who have talked to the mayor, and the mayor may come out and say he doesn't like it, but that's his prerogative to do what he would like to do there. I'm also, I guess, a little bit amazed by the conversation about Minneapolis and St. Paul legislators, whether they're are willing to sign on to this. And I, Representative Benson, I certainly have a great deal of respect for you, and I think it's a good question. I think it's a good question because I wonder why they're not, and why they aren't having this discussion and being a part of the bill and saying maybe this is a way that we can help support Minneapolis and St. Paul. You know, the governor was quoted in an opinion article yesterday of saying that the Minneapolis School District, he had some pretty disparaging words about the Minneapolis School District that I don't necessarily agree with and I don't think is helpful to the conversation. But when the governor of the state recognizes that Minneapolis has some issues we have to address, I appreciate you bringing this forward. And I am a co-author of the bill because I think this is the good discussion to have. And I appreciate you bringing it forward. And, you know, I think it would bring some additional benefit to the Minneapolis and St. Paul School District, and would like to see us use it as an example. And if Minneapolis and St. Paul decide they don't want to do it, the permissive language in this bill says they don't have to do it. It just gives them one additional tool, and I hope we can kind of move that conversation back towards the merits or even the bad points of the idea. So thank you, Representative Kelly, for bringing it forward.
Representative Depke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine is just a general question on the amount of time that the mayor may oversee the schools, and it's my understanding that the mayor may govern for 10 years. Is there a precedence on that with other large cities that have chosen to go this route? Is there a 10-year a limit or an opportunity to reevaluate the situation at the end of 10 years. Once they do it, they're on this track for 10 years. Could you please clarify that for me?
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Dipke, yes, basically the sunset provision was in there so that we did have the opportunity to reevaluate and assess how things are going, how the governance model works. That was simply the only reason to put it in.
Representative Dipke?
Regarding the appointed school board members, and I think they're four-year terms at staggered intervals, it's up to the mayor, then I would assume he could reappoint for another 4 years if he so chose, and is the 10-year limit the same for the school board members as well?
Madam Chair and Peterson, right. Representative Dipke, the 10-year model is for the mayoral control governance model. The terms would be appointed by the mayor, and you're correct. He would be able to reappoint, he or she would be able to reappoint those members as they saw fit.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly.
Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to just piggyback on what Representative Woodward was talking about. You know, we're kind of jumping ahead here, I think. We've kind of dug our heels in, I think, maybe a little bit to a solution or lack thereof and having our perspectives on that. But I'd like to kind of bring us back to kind of some numbers that really disturbed me a minute ago, which is that the graduation rate in Minneapolis is 49%. You know, that's half the kids aren't graduating, I guess, is what that means, right? They go through the public school system, and half of them graduate, half do not. Something a little bit additionally disturbing that I know of, that I've looked at, just happened to come across the information, is that Minneapolis parents, the parents and the families that live in the city of Minneapolis, 30% of those families open and roll their kids out of the Minneapolis public school system. That's not saying they go to private schools. We don't know that number. If you add that number in, you'd probably find that number going a lot higher than 30%. But 30% of the Minneapolis-St. Paul families open and roll their kids out of the public school system to another school. And so they've said that it's not working for them and they want another option. Then we have an achievement gap that is, in our state, is the largest in the country, minus Washington, D.C. So the question I think Representative Mariani had a few minutes ago was a great one. Why Minneapolis-St. Paul? And to me, I guess the question for Representative Kelly, you might not know the answer, but maybe the department does. You look at the achievement gap, you're looking at kids who are either doing well or not doing well. So the question I have is, how many kids aren't doing well in our state based on the achievement gap, and where do they reside? Where do they go to school? I think we have a lot of kids in Minneapolis that just go to Minneapolis. We have a lot of kids that go to St. Paul, and there's a lot of kids who aren't doing well. So to me, there's a lot of opportunity to reach a certain group of kids at a couple school districts. So the question is, Representative Kelly, if you know, do you know the numbers? Do you know how many kids are on the wrong side of that gap? And are they in Minneapolis and St. Paul, or are they in another district? I'm not talking about a percentage. I'm talking about actual numbers of kids who we could help by changing, providing stability, doing something different than what we're doing now.
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Barrett, I have to say I don't have that number-wise. The statistics we've always been working with are the percentages, but the percentages are pretty glaring, as you've noted as well, from a proficiency standpoint in generalities. When we can look at a 20-point gap in regards to state averages, that's troubling, and that's where we can say certainly they are the largest districts in the state as well. So the numbers would be there. We could ask the department to take a look at that.
Well, I think that's
the department to come down. Yeah. Representative Barrett.
Hey, Madam Chair, I think that's a good foundational question to ask. How many kids, and I look at this as an opportunity, how many kids do we have the opportunity to help through a bill like this or other bills that help kids who are on the wrong side of that gap?
Welcome to the testifying table, Mr. McHenry. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members, Kevin McHenry, Department of Education, and Representative Barrett. I don't have the numbers on me right now as far as what you're looking for, but that's something that we can garner, put together, and give that to all committee members here.
Thank you, Mr. McHenry. Representative Barrett.
Sure, that'd be great. I'd appreciate that. I think what I'm looking for is the number of kids by district who are on the wrong side of our achievement gap in our state. to determine which districts would be most beneficial by changing up their management structure.
Representative Barrett, you know, there are several schools in Minneapolis-St. Paul, so every school has a different achievement level. And Mr. McHenry, I think that would be most beneficial if you broke it out by schools. Thank you very much. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I won't belabor this because you have lots of other folks that want to talk, and we haven't really dug into the bill. And frankly, I think we should. I actually welcome this conversation. I like the state's legislature's focus on my school district. I think that's terrific, and I think that I like the focus also on systemic structure of our existing public schools. That's much far better conversation, I believe, than we've had in the past, where we've been focusing on anything but our public schools, taking monies out of our regular public schools and putting them into private schools, for instance. That does nothing to drive systemic reform. I look forward to hearing from my school district about systemic reform efforts. But I do want to say very quickly that, you know, I don't sign on to bills, Representative Woodard, unless there's some really strong research that says this is a good idea. That's how I felt 3 or 4 years ago when I supported the alternative certification bill. I thought the research was there. I bucked a heck of a lot of folks in my own party on that. And over time, a number of them, in fact, majority of them, came around and said, you know, there is really good sound research there. And so that's why I'm not, that's one of the reasons why I'm not on this bill. And I also, quite frankly, am concerned that while I appreciate the focus on my school district in an intelligent way, hopefully, that I hope that this doesn't morph into sort of a cheap legislative, and I'm not, I apologize, Representative Kelly, I'm not ascribing that to you, but in general, I hope that none of this morphs into a cheap way for us to say, you know, St. Paul, your problem, your issue, you fix it, just restructure. And later on, I think we're going to hear from my school district on some of the challenges that that school district faces. And I'll speak briefly at that point of something that I've been learning recently about kind of the big social trends that have been having a horrible impact on kids, not only in St. Paul, but all across our state as our poverty rates continue to rise in the state, which I think requires far more intelligent approaches than just simply saying, you know, you can restructure and then we'll walk away from all our other commitments. I hope that's not what we're saying here. But I do like the focus on the issue of structure of an organization, of systemic reform behind that, on the achievement gap, absolutely. And so I look forward to hearing from the rest of the testifiers here, Madam Chair.
With that, Representative Kelly, I would like to know in the audience, are there others who would like to speak in support of House File 2621 as amended? Then let's turn to those who have concerns. And do I have a list? I have a list. Mr. Garathwell and Ms. Gilbert, would you like to come forward, please? That's just the agenda.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jim Grathball. I represent the Minneapolis
Public
Schools.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you
very
much.
And I'm joined by a board member, Rebecca Gagnon. And by introducing this board member, we haven't done anything to increase or accelerate the achievement of students in Minneapolis. But I did want you to know we've got a board member with us. I'm going to go out on a limb and I'll let you know, even though my board has not formally taken a position on this bill, that the Minneapolis Public Schools opposes the bill. We appreciate the author bringing it forward and having a good conversation, and the DE3 amendment makes some changes that we think are improve the bill. But fundamentally, I have a single talking point. There is no research, credible research, that supports the notion that change of governance structure will close the achievement gap in any school district. If the pages will come forward, I do have a handout that will actually give you a little update on where we are in terms of closing that achievement gap and identify an achievement gap. There you go. So there's two pieces there.
Thank
identifying
you, Mr.
An achievement gap isn't an argument. There's an achievement gap in the Minneapolis public schools. There's an achievement gap in pretty much every district in the state of Minnesota. We're working very hard on closing that achievement gap. The two pieces you have coming around document how we're doing with that and how the strategic plan the superintendent and this board have designed and implemented is closing or bridging the difference between a vision of every child college and career ready and where we are in terms of the numbers today. And what that strategic plan has done, let me just cut to the chase and say, the research, you want us to do what's research-based to close the achievement gap. What's research-based is effective teaching, effective site leadership, getting rigorous courses for all students, extending the school day, extending the school year. The packet you have in front of you talks about our progress working on all those fronts. So if you want us to follow the research, let us continue the work we're doing. If you want to have a debate and discussion about governance, we welcome it, but it's not central to what we believe our work is in closing the achievement gap. I'll come down on the side of an elected school board. 100,000 people in Minneapolis voted for the Minneapolis Public School Board. Representative Barrett asked questions about kind of enrollment in, enrollment out. We can answer those questions, Representative Barrett, and I'd be happy to help you with that.
So, Mr. Grathwell, what in the bill, or maybe to the school board member, what in the bill would be something you'd want to address in your testimony? Because I appreciate everything you've provided us with. But I think the debate has to be on this delete everything amendment and what it addresses. It has a school site council, has an educational advisory council. It has a way to take care of the appointment of school boards. And perhaps the school board representative could comment on the pros and cons of the provision before us. Thank you, Mr. Grathwell. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony in regard to this proposal.
Thank you. My name is Rebecca Gagnon. I'm a citywide elected school board member in Minneapolis. And the one thing I find most disturbing about the bill is the lack of elected representation of parents. And the studies have conclusively shown much damage to parents and communities when they are not represented by elected school board members. They are lacking their voice, and it hurts underrepresented communities of color the most, which is exactly wherein lies the gap. And the studies have also stated that if you are doing this for achievement alone, don't do it. So those are... I am a very research, data-driven school board member, and those facts alone lead me to vehemently not support this bill.
Thank you very much. That was very relevant, and I appreciated your statements about what you see as a weakness within this proposal. Are there questions for the school board member? Representative Greiling, is your question for the school board member?
Madam Chair, no, although she did make one of the points I was going to make, so I'm glad that she did. The role of the community, the role of the elected school board member, the role of parents. But so she's made that point. I won't make it again when I make my comments, but I have others when I get to me on the list.
Thank you. Are there questions specifically for Mr. Grathwell or Ms. Gagnon? Thank you very much. We may be calling you back down.
Thank you very much.
Are there others who have concerns and would like to address the provisions in this proposal specifically, please? Welcome to our testifying table. Please say your name for the record.
Thank you and good morning, members. I'm Mary Gilbert. I'm the legislative liaison for the St. Paul Public Schools. And my board chair did have an opportunity to meet with Representative Kelly, and I think he reiterated The concern that we have is that generally when this has been proposed in other cities, the school districts have been in complete disarray. The buildings have been filthy sometimes, not well kept. The academics were questionable. The finances generally were a mess as well. In some cases, there was wholesale corruption. And as our chair pointed out to him, that is not the state of the St. Paul Public School right now. And the concern that we have about this legislation, that if it gives any signal to our public, especially as we're looking to renew our referendum this fall, that there's a lack of confidence in the school, especially after we undertook a whole year regarding our Strong School, Strong Community plan, that's not a signal that we want to have going to our community right now. And I think Representative Kelly was careful about that and understood that as well. There is a great, great sense of urgency about closing the achievement gap in St. Paul, and that really is what the Strong School Plan is all about. When our last superintendent left, the board specifically chose a superintendent, Valeria Silva, who you've all met, who has got more passion for closing the achievement gap, I think, than maybe anybody in the state. And wants to retire. She has got 30 years of experience in St. Paul, and she wants to retire in St. Paul. And so the board specifically dealt with the issue about stability when it chose her as the superintendent. She did lead, and the board backed her in some very difficult discussions around our strategic plan. And as part of that strategic plan, it is a very, very solid relationship that we have with the mayor and the city, because we understand that our kids, based on the financial circumstances and housing that many of them are in, need a safe place to be. Our kids want to go to school on release days and in the summer. They want to be in a safe environment, and they want to have be around safe in safe environments and with adults. The handout that you have, and I actually had it on a PowerPoint presentation, but the whole thing here intimidated me too much. I just want you to refresh your memory about the makeup of our school district. It is starkly different than the average population in the state, particularly as it relates to our poverty and our rich language that we have. In fact, you could argue that St. Paul probably is the most diverse school district in the country. Based on its makeup, and it also has one of the most robust choice programs. I would put our choice program up to any single city in the country right now. On the second page, what I'd like to point out, because this is going to be important information, this is a four-year trend of students that are new to our district. Now, this does not include kindergarten. These are students that enter our district over the last 4 years by grade. Of that top graph there, I want you to note the bottom graph, which are of the 16,700 new students that we get, 7,788 of them do not speak English. And if you look at the trend, and particularly pay attention to the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, look at the number of new students that come to our district that are refugees, that enter our school as secondary students. And especially you can see that the trend for ninth grade from 2008 has gone from 258 pupils to 343, and that it's growing. We have 1,420 Karen-speaking students that have enrolled in our district in the last couple of years. we couldn't even find a Karen interpreter when we had the first families enroll. And so we constantly respond to the refugees that come to our district because we do welcome everyone and we expect that they all achieve at high standards. St. Paul is closing the achievement gap. Again, we are beating the odds. You've been kind enough to visit our schools, and you've been kind enough to have some principals and our superintendent in here, so this committee has heard about some of the great successes. We've been recognized nationally for ELL outcomes, and I'm going to, in a couple minutes, talk to you more about our NCLB graduation rate, especially in relationship to the comments by Jim Bartholomew. We are closing the gap on our graduation rate, and we're doing it across all ethnic groups. We had a blip with our Native American Indians. We had 700 more students that were proficient in reading last year alone. And again, by every ethnic group, we have closed the gap. When we took a look at our growth, because as you know, we started at many of our schools and students start a completely different starting point. For example, the seven schools that have the new immigrants obviously don't come out of the chute with a high proficiency rate on reading and math since they're new to the country. But when we took a look at how we were performing against other schools in the state, 27 of our schools outperformed the state average in medium and high growth for math. 35 outperformed the state in medium high growth for reading. And that success was across, it wasn't just our schools, you know, our gifted and talented school. That included some of our language academies that have the most serious challenges. So the success, and 17 of that group actually outperformed the state in both reading and math. So it's not just Dayton's Bluff that is doing well or one other school. We are moving the bar in most of the schools, and the ones that we aren't, we're taking a serious look at them as well.
So, Ms. Gilbert, I hate to interrupt you, but to the delete everything amendment, your argument would be that this shouldn't even be an option because St. Paul is now stable. Ms. Gilbert?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. I think, again, the need, as it has been expressed by some of the witnesses, the need for this bill is because of some of the data that they presented related to our achievement gap. And I just want to inform the committee about the data so that we're all, you know, getting the information as we consider this. And I do appreciate that the author has made this permissive, you know, on the part of the mayors. So I'll be quick, Madam Chair. I do want to run through the rest of this information. The NCLB graduation rate, as you can see by the next graph, we are closing the achievement gap, and if for all students it's 90%. What Mr. Bartholomew was talking about was a four-year graduation rate, which was 75% for the state and 63.2% for St. Paul. What he didn't tell you is that we have 22.8% of our students that actually continue. Now, if you go back to the graph about students that are new to the district, I would just imagine all of you getting plunked down in Myanmar as a ninth grader and expected to learn their language and attain all the graduation requirements that we have in place in 4 years. And so our dropout rate compared to the state is 7.2%, even with the four-year rate, compared to 4.9 at the state level. So I think I would just like to put that in some context for you. In addition, I want you to know that we are, again, we've asked our voters to provide a four-year-old, five-day kindergarten program for 1,000 students. Our voters have paid for all-day kindergarten, knowing that the early learning piece is important. We have intentionally moved toward literacy blocks, aligned math curriculum, reading instruction at the secondary grade. Again, we've had to respond based on the new students that we have in our district. We have refocused as part of our student plan everything intentionally to deal with the achievement gap. We have replicated successful programs, and we have closed many programs in schools that have not worked, often in spite of parents begging us and students coming to board meetings and crying that we keep them open. We've developed a principal leadership model that now has been adopted by the state, and we have a performance system in place for every single employee in the district. I'll close with the fact that we have an accountability plan in place. We welcome our budget system. Our budget information is on our website. All of our student data is on our website. I would invite any of you to go look at it. We reported annually to our community. We have some of the lowest administrative costs in the state. We've been recognized nationally for our efficient energy use and transportation. And again, I think our bigger concern about this is that there would be any notion out there in the public that our board and our superintendent is not absolutely serious about closing the achievement gap, and that we are a system where we spend our tax dollars wisely, and that our first priority is the students.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Would you give me an approximate year, school year, in which you began your greatest effort to close the achievement gap? Because your tables are showing starting in 2008-09, Did it precede that, Ms. Gilbert?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. The last couple of superintendents that we had have instituted different kinds of models. Pat Harvey, if you remember, really focused on elementary literacy and trying to do some wholesale changes in how we train our elementary school staff, and so the focus began there. when Maria Karstarfin was here, she started the system where we started to close some of the schools that were not performing well. It was culminated by a community-wide discussion with our strategic plan where we made further changes to our choice program so that we could align the programs that were successful, close the ones that were not, and then try and reduce some of our administrative and transportation costs so that we could refocus the money on the schools. And that actually is just taking place right now. Some of the changes that will happen to go to the regional magnet system and more neighborhood schools is actually going to occur this fall. So,
Ms. Gilbert, how many years did Pat Harvey serve as superintendent?
I think she might have been here for 6 or 7.
6 years. And Ms. Karstarfin was 2, is that correct?
Yeah,
or
2.5, I believe.
Thank you very much. Representative Norton, it was your question for Ms. Gilbert. Thank you.
Well, it relates. She probably can answer it, or perhaps even you can, Madam Chair. My question kind of stems from Representative Barrett's comments about graduation rates, and then what I was hearing here, which I know to be true in my district, where four-year graduation rates are not always the best measure, and that we actually, with our ELL learners, have talked a lot about helping those families understand that if you've just moved here in high school, that you may not graduate in 12th grade, and that that's a very reasonable expectation, and that as they learn the language and then have to learn the curriculum, that going an extra year is okay. And that's been something we've had to actually help our parents understand and our students understand, that it's not a failure to go another year if you're new to this country and need to graduate. So as we're having this discussion, Madam Chair, perhaps you can answer the question. I think I know the answer, but I want to clarify. At what age does the state of Minnesota require students to be enrolled in school?
Are you asking me?
Whomever knows. I mean, perhaps
Ms. Gilbert.
Madam Chair, there is no requirement that students attend kindergarten. There has to be enrollment by the time, I believe,
first grade.
Ms. Larson, I'm sure, could correct me, by the time they're in the seventh grade.
I'm wondering about the other end. How long do they have to go?
Madam Chair.
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Go ahead.
They can. A student can, if they haven't graduated, go up until the year of their 21st birthday.
And how soon can they leave, I'm trying to get at? What age do we require students to stay in school until?
16.
Representative Norton, it's 16.
Thank you. And that's the point I wanted to make, sort of in response to Representative Barrett and what I'm hearing here. While we encourage kids to stay in as long as it takes to graduate, we as a state only require students to go to school until they're age 16. So when we lament the dropout rate, I think we need to acknowledge that part of that is the state requirement that says they only have to go till 16. And we have tried for years to stretch it to 18, but there is cost to our court system and to our schools to do such. So I just, as we're having this discussion and considering graduation rates, I want you to consider that state law has a role to play in that, as do we sitting at this table. Thank you.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could just interject, a lot of this conversation that Ms. Gilbert presented, we had yesterday, and if you hear it, I think it's very intriguing, and it seems like a great opportunity. So I almost feel like Ms. Gilbert is here on behalf of this bill, because why in the world wouldn't we want to keep this going? This is the stability we need. We have continued. I think your question, Madam Chair, to say when did we start this? I think if we look back historically, we could probably see moments in time that there was a push and it was going that way. But what about those people that were displaced, or the schools were closed, or you irritated the point that said, I'm going to run for school board? And one of the worst things is a school board member who has a single purpose, a single issue person, and gets on the board just to create problems. So I'm very enlightened by all the information. I think it's fantastic, and we had a wonderful conversation. So I think this is a great opportunity.
Thank you.
And again, this is permissive language.
Yes, this is permissive. This is just an opportunity that would be out there. Ms. Gilbert.
Chair, I would be remiss if I didn't introduce one of our board members, Mary Duran, if she wants to just wave, who came to the board and ran because she had exactly that same sense of urgency of closing the achievement gap.
Welcome to our committee. Good to have you. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to be really quick. And actually, I thought that was a really good conversation there. And she's leaving, so I won't ask the question, Ms. Gilbert. But part of what I heard was that in the testimony is that, and it was borne out when I went to visit my local elementary, Cherokee Heights, a couple weeks ago with my Congresswoman, Betty McCollum. And one of the things, I learned quite a few things, by the way. And one of the most daunting, disturbing things I learned is that about a third of the kids enrolled in that school, estimate, a third of those kids were either had parents who were currently incarcerated or had been incarcerated. And I had a conversation with Representative Greiling afterwards, because the other thing I learned was the high uncared for mental illness issues that many of these young children face, because we don't have a decent healthcare system that provides for long-term clinical therapy. And so that's a whole other area we don't talk a lot about here. It has a direct bearing on what happens inside of our schools. And of course, there's a close correlation, as Representative Greiling reminded me, between mental health, untreated mental health issues and incarceration issues. Nonetheless, that school on growth measurements, not proficiency admittedly, but on growth measurements, which means there's learning happening, exceeded the statewide average by 10 percentage points. It was like 81% growth measures, if I remember correctly, over mid-70s percent in a statewide average. And so I think that's, you know, a testament or supports your testimony here in terms of, you know, there are some really good things happening here, and Representative Kelly has acknowledged that. However, I want to ask the question because it will take time, and I'm taking too much time now. I believe I'm correct when I say that even though that's happening, the school district is not satisfied. You know, the testimony here is not about being satisfied here. It's really about the concern over the stability issue. And Representative Kelly, you know, during the same period of time of superintendents that the chair asked of Ms. Gilbert, you know, we went through Norm Coleman, Mayor Kelly, and now Chris Coleman. And, you know, Norm started out his tenure as mayor of St. Paul by attacking the St. Paul school districts. I know because I called him on the carpet on that issue. So that was his initial, posture. Representative Kelly was focused, I think rightfully so, on early literacy issues. But that was the only thing he was focused on. Mayor Coleman has a much more broader approach, a much more collaborative approach in terms of relating with the schools. Mayor Kelly also was a major supporter for the baseball stadium issue, which had huge political ramifications for my city. It split kind of our party kind of in half in our city, created all sorts of controversy. And so I want you to think about, you know, this issue of stability. You know, instability also comes with mayoral elections. It comes with the particular issues, whether they're good guys or bad guys, or good women or bad women. It comes with the particular issue that those mayors are focused on. And we all know this. Mayors run on a number of platforms, including Mayor Kelly on the stadium issue, which wound up being his undoing as mayor of St. Paul. And so for us to tie, you know, some kind of a long-term stable agenda to what I think is an inherently unstable electoral process in regards to mayors running for office is something that we should pause and think very carefully about.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Mariani, something you stated earlier today was just the fact that you appreciate the fact that we were focused on your district. And I think that's part of the benefits of this, because there actually is a focal point then, and that is the mayor's office. I want to read you a quick quote by Thomas Menino, who's the Boston's mayor. And this is the way he when he was running for mayor, said, if I want to be judged as your mayor by what happens now in the Boston public schools. If I fail to bring about these specific reforms by the year 2001, then judge me harshly. And I think that's a great focal point. That's a great time to focus this, because now if they're not achieving, if they're not doing what they said they do, that is the ultimate accountability as they get elected out. So I really like the focal point being that mayor's office.
Representative Mariani.
Representative Kelly, and this is not a harsh disagreement, but you know, bully for the mayor of Boston. You know, my concern here is the member of the K-12 Education Committee has to do with the kids in our public schools in St. Paul. And so it's great, you know, it's a great, you know, kind of, you know, thing for the mayor of Boston that attached to his resume. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in the well-being of the kids in St. Paul. And I think what we heard from my school district is that there's some serious stability issues that we have to think about here. And I think we agree on that, and we just sort of have a slightly different take on it.
And remember, members, remember, this is permissive. This is not something anyone has to do, whether it's Minneapolis or St. Paul. Representative Mariani, I think you should be very pleased with what's happening at Cherokee Heights, because it shows that you have effective teachers, because in spite of what their home life is like, they're growing in their education. And what a salute to Cherokee Heights teachers. Are there others who would like to testify with concerns? Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record.
Madam Chair, I'm Louise Sundin from the city of Minneapolis. I'm a 30-year ninth grade English teacher and in Minneapolis schools, resident of Minneapolis lifelong, and an 8-year member of the Minneapolis Charter Commission. A long time ago, however. I want to commend the chair for her lesson in history. It's not bad for an English teacher, Madam Chair. And I would maybe just throw in one line on behalf of Mary Catherine Ricker, who is the president of the St. Paul Federation of Teachers, and they take quite pride in the 1946 strike in St. Paul for the children. And it was the first in the nation. So they are. It was an historic event. With your indulgence, I'd like to just make a few quick points in opposition to even the amendment. The first thing is that I think that the legacy of mayoral control in Minneapolis, which goes back to 1959, admittedly before my term in leadership in Minneapolis, but it took until 2010 and 2011 in this body to fix the pension issues that were caused by mayoral control in Minneapolis, and those are MRF and TRA issues. The second thing is that the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul have their hands full and have a lot on their plates. They're trying to run cities on less than sufficient local government aid, I might add, maintaining adequate police and fire to protect all of us, and fixing bridges that fall down, and streets and roads, at least in my neighborhood, that are pretty riddled with potholes, and the politics of a new Viking stadium are kind of weigh heavily on their time, and not all of their challenges that they espoused when they became mayors have been met, so we still see blue tarps after the tornado in North Minneapolis, and we wish that the mayor would continue his great partnering with the schools, trying to assist the schools, coalesce communities around them, but not run them. On my time in Minneapolis Charter Commission and since then, there have probably been maybe a dozen different attempts in Minneapolis to become a strong mayor city. They were strongly rejected every single time it's ever been tried. It is not the Minneapolis way, and it is not the wishes of the citizens of my city to have a mayor that runs everything. The third thing is that my colleagues in the Teacher Union Reform Network represent all of the cities that have been used as examples of good mayoral control. They would not agree. Over the last 15 years in our coalescing as the most progressive teacher union leaders in the country, every one of them AFT leaders, they have been the consistent leaders in those districts, and they have advanced a reform agenda that is, and they have been the ones to articulate that reform agenda. And so the stability has been in their leadership, and that is leadership that we believe is strong and necessary, and have created substantial reforms and maintained and articulated those reforms in those cities. So where does the research show that mayors taking over city schools works. In my reading of the about 36 reports on it in the last week or so, I have not been able to find one, nor in my emails to my colleagues around the country. Cleveland has been the longest running mayoral control. I don't think we'd use them as an example of anything. The New York City version means that parents and public have no voice whatsoever. The autocratic system in New York is run by what is called a panel of educational puppets. And the educational puppets, if they utter a public word, it darn well better be in support of his honor, the mayor, or else their history. So when two of his appointees threatened to vote independently, they were fired on the spot. So Bloomberg said that mayoral control means mayoral control. They are my representatives, and they're going to vote things I believe in. Thank you very much. So in conclusion, do mayors do better? Depends on how you feel about democracy and how you feel about families and citizens having real input in the running of the schools. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Woodard?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick comment. I appreciate your testimony. And you brought up something that I've been searching for, which is, I think, some common ground here. And I think my DFL colleagues will agree with me on this, that maybe if we gave our mayors a little bit more to deal with and focus on the kids, maybe they could stop messing around with the stadium. And so they could focus their efforts a little bit. And I think I might find some bipartisan support on that particular issue. So I wanted to make sure we didn't let a common ground go unnoticed. So thank
Madam
you very
Chair
much.
And Representative Woodward, so I happen to be a stadium fan and a proponent for my brothers in the building trade. So I won't agree with you on that one. Thank
Representative Barrett, is your question for Ms. Senden?
No, it isn't.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any question for Ms. Senden before she leaves? Welcome to the testifying table. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Stein. I went on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association and representing all elected public school board members in the state at all public school districts. And while each district has its uniqueness to them, there's one thing that's common among them all is that they are run by elected school board members. And I think that, and I know that is an important piece from a school board association perspective. They come from various backgrounds within the community and don't do this because they enjoy sitting in uncomfortable seats for long periods of time. They don't enjoy less than tasty coffee at meetings that run forever and ever. They do it because they believe they can make a difference. They do it because they believe that they've had an experience in the public schools that they feel that they can pay back and provide a meaningful education for their community's kids. So research, despite what many people believe that the mayoral takeover is the solution, there is research out there that shows that effective school board members can make a difference in student achievement. Among many things that school board members do is they commit to a vision of high expectations. And we know that we've heard from the Minneapolis and St. Paul school boards and their representatives that they're moving in that direction. They are accountability and results driven. They're spending less time on operational issues and more focused on student achievement. That's what effective school boards do. They are a data savvy. They look at results. Never before have we had as much data available to our school board members and teachers to make strong instructional decisions for our students. And one of the things that's issue with us in this bill is that they hire an effective and transformational superintendent. And that's one thing that this bill does not allow us to do. The mayor takes control of this, and he or she then appoints the board members. Just flips it on an ear, where the board members' key responsibility, one of the biggest jobs that they have before them, is hiring a leader that's going to make a difference for their students. I think that's one of the key issues that we have a major concern with. So all of these characteristics, to me, seem to appear within the districts, the strategic plan that they have before them. Now the bill is permissive, and MSBA represents all public school districts. We still believe the best way to govern school districts is by those citizens who live within the community who are elected by the residents in that community. and those who are accountable to the citizens of the community through the ballot box. And we also have numerous public and private school options that people can vote with their feet if they so choose. So we are concerned about the stability of the bill, of course. We understand it is permissive, and there's nothing requiring school districts or school boards to go down this path. But we are concerned about perhaps the precedent that this sets. It's not clear to me that there is an exit strategy. That obviously at 10 years, that time period's up. What now happens to the board members? The issue of per diem. I realize school board members don't do this for the hard seats and the long meetings and the per diem or the pay, but that is one of the issues you need to consider as you move forward here, is what quality of leadership and school board member are you going to get if they have to volunteer that amount of time as you proceed. I will also just close by saying that there is research that by the Phi Delta Kappa that talks about who does the community value more than anybody. And they value locally elected school board members more than any other I shouldn't say that, but more than... Can I push the rewind button, ma'am? But I think it's an important indication that the citizens of their community believe in the school board members. They're close to them. They can talk to them. They can share their concerns. And I think that matters to them when they know that they've cast their ballot. Madam Chair, I'll be happy for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schneiderwind. I think Representative Mariani has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for citing Phi Delta Kappa. And I do that all the time. People go, what? very quick question. Representative Kelly does raise an important issue. We focused on this about stability of leadership over time. And I think it's a good discussion for us to have. Given that Minnesota, I'm going to put you on the spot, Minnesota Statute 123B.143 Subdivision 1 currently limits superintendent contracts to 3 years, which begs a stability question. Would your association look favorably on having school boards' ability to be freed from that arbitrary decision, if you will, and that's a little loaded, but by that direction on the part of state statute?
Mr. Schneiderwind.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, that is a great question. I think that's one of the issues that we have seen in doing the research on the mayoral takeover is the issue of stability of the superintendent and stability of leadership. I would also say that the reverse is true. There's not a guarantee that, and I think you hit on this, there's no guarantee that a mayoral takeover is going to provide any more stability. I do think that at this point I'm going to hedge, and I think it's something that we would have to have a discussion about, but I think that at one point, and perhaps I don't want to put Ms. Larson on the spot, but I think at one point there was the issue where superintendents did have tenure, and that part of the trade-off for that tenure was a limited three-year contract. So, but that's a different story for a different day, and we'll certainly have that discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Schneiderwind. Is there anyone in the audience who has traveled specifically to testify to the concerns of this bill who is not paid? Any lay person out there who would like to speak before I place this meeting in recess? Okay. With that, members, we'll resume this meeting at 6:30 in the basement. This meeting stands in recess. Members, we'll end our recess and convene again to continue our discussion on H2621 as amended. And we still have some who want to ask questions. Oh, I guess we still have testifiers, too. Are there those in the audience who would like to come forward and express concerns? Thank you, Department. You'll lead us off. Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members, Kevin McHenry, Department of Education. Just want to thank you all for the chance to come up and testify on the bill. Obviously, we are always interested in initiatives to increase achievement and close the achievement gap. So I think we were interested in seeing how this discussion went. I don't know if we have a we want to from a department perspective. I don't think this is something that we're coming at saying we are in support of or we are completely against. But we do want to see how this moves forward and how the discussion proceeds. A couple of things I did want to point out, just from maybe the technical perspective. I think you had asked us to focus on the bill. So one thing I did want to point out is just. You know, as far as there's a portion in here where the mayor would appoint a CEO of the district, mm-hmm. I think that's something that from the department's perspective we would raise concern. Right now, administrators do have specific qualifications. They have specific education requirements that they need to follow and adhere to in order to be eligible to run a school district. And so this proposed bill establishes the CEO of the school board appointed by the mayor, but is not required to have any educational experience whatsoever. And so that's just one, I think that's a point that we'd like to raise, as well as, you know, obviously we appreciate the change of being it from a shall to a may, looking into that. But we just felt that we still, maybe that CEO position instead of a superintendent might have some, might want to have some educational requirements to that. And also as far as, I'm not too sure, as the amendment changed, one of the things we looked at is the effective date. Now that this moves from a may or a shall to a may, how that actually affects this bill. Because in it is as effective date is whenever the most recently elected school board member's term ends. And so that was something that we thought could be an issue as far as when the new members are appointed to the board, what type of you know, learning curve there is for a new school board, you know, especially if the person in charge doesn't necessarily have that educational background. So I think those are just some of the, a couple of the technical points we just wanted to raise, obviously, to the author and to you all just for your consideration and appreciate the chance to come forward in front of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. McHenry, and thank you for addressing the bill. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm glad you raised the question, actually, of appointing a CEO, because actually, if we look at the example of Chicago, it's interesting for the last 14 years, and the people that they've appointed have not been from education, and they've been able to achieve some fantastic results. And I think sometimes we get very, very fearful of change as we look at what we're doing in education. That always surprises me, because our task is teaching kids how to learn and how to adapt to change, and sometimes we're very, very we're some of the toughest to accept change. So actually, I would look at that as a positive sometimes when we look at being able to bring in experience that has just a little different vision and a little different look to it, as opposed to everyone always coming from inside of education. Just yesterday when I spoke to the school board chair, I believe she's a past 3M'er for 35 years. And I tell you, that's a very, very impressive person to be at the head of the school board for St. Paul. I was very impressed, and we had a wonderful conversation. So that's a new look and a new vision that she's able to bring. So so I actually look at that as a positive.
Thank you, Mr. McHenry. Oh, does someone have a question for him? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McHenry, during the discussion this morning, there was, you know, talk about why Minneapolis and St. Paul are included in this legislation and not other areas of the state. And we're talking about the fact that every district does have, to one degree or another, children who are on free and reduced lunch or who, you know, have many of the social challenges that kids in Minneapolis and St. Paul have. And so I'm just wondering whether or not the department has any statistical evidence or information about whether the percentage of children living in poverty, we'll say, who attend other school districts graduate at a higher rate than children who have similar social economic challenges who live in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And the reason I want to know that question is that would maybe be an explanation as to why the author would identify Minneapolis and St. Paul for this particular arrangement rather than, you know, Brooklyn Park or Edina or other places throughout the state. I'm not sure I made my question clear, but...
Mr. McHenry.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I don't think I can recite that recite that data just off the top of my head, but that is something that we can get data for. I've also requested some data from earlier that was asked, but I guess what your question you're asking is, do you want to find students that may have the same, maybe the same free and reduced percentages, what they do outside of the Minneapolis and St. Paul districts, and compare those. I can definitely talk with our the people in the department that compile that data and see if we can get an answer for you.
Well, Madam Chair, just to continue a little bit, you know, it's very difficult, of course, to find exact parallels. There are all kinds of other items that or effects that would impact that. So I, you know, understand that, but I'm just wondering whether or not the author, when he was writing this bill, found that somehow Minneapolis and St. Paul were less successful with children attending those schools than children in similar circumstances outstate or in the suburbs or whatever. Because that seems to be, I don't know, that's kind of the feeling I got, that Representative Kelly, you had a sense that somehow Minneapolis and St. Paul were falling down in relationship to achievement levels for children similarly situated in other school districts. And I'd just like to ask you the question, do you have that information, or what led you to identify Minneapolis and St. Paul, other than the fact that you said earlier that there are a lot of children who are challenged in those two districts?
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, yes, it was a global look. It was the percentages that have continued to, we're looking at 20 percentage points, the difference between math, reading, and science assessment in relation to across the board. No, specifically to your question as to children specifically in the same situation, no. But what we're talking about is the global population. It's the tyranny of the math with numbers. When we look at the population of Minneapolis and St. Paul, they certainly outweigh the differences between selecting a group of children that are in the exact same situation in other districts. So it's trying to attack a problem reaching the masses. And that's why we looked at it this way.
Madam Chair.
Representative Benson?
Well, you know, I don't represent Minneapolis or St. Paul. I represent Western Suburban District. But, you know, the years I've been here, it seems that many people are very concerned about whether or not Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts are achieving certain levels of attainment, and less concerned about other districts. And just because there may be smaller numbers of children in these other school districts, I don't think they're any less deserving of intervention. And so I just find it peculiar that you do not make this a universal objective then, or opportunity, instead of just concentrating. Because I really do think, you know, I live in Hennepin County, and that's Minneapolis too, but I just have a kind of a, I've had a sense over the years that people in greater Minnesota and suburban areas are constantly worrying about superintending Minneapolis and St. Paul and not really taking care of their own areas carefully enough. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. McHenry. Ms. Delsland? Representative Dabney, did you have a question for Mr. McHenry in regard
no,
to
I
the
don't.
Bill? Or
I have some information
okay.
to the committee.
Go ahead, Representative Dabney.
Ah, thank you, Madam Chair. If the page would be so kind and distribute these. I provided this to the chair. There was an issue this morning about where the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul were on this. What the page will be distributing is a clearer sense, a clearer statement from Mayor Rybeck of his opposition to this bill. But I also want to take this as an opportunity to apologize to Representative Kelly. We spoke privately already. I was intemperate in my comments, and you don't deserve that. As I said, we spoke privately, but I said them publicly, so I feel obligated to publicly apologize as well.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I certainly appreciate that, and you're exactly correct. I think, unfortunately, the letter that was written was a little ambiguous to exactly what the mayor intended. I think what you'll see here is the mayor specifically states that he's not in support of this bill. What I can tell you is that the email's message is going back and forth, is saying that we still are looking forward to a conversation. We're setting up a meeting to meet on it, and the mayor looks forward to that conversation. But he is clearly not in support of this bill at this time. And thank you, Representative Dabney.
Ms. Dilsland, please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dilsland, and I represent the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. MASA fully supports partnerships and collaborations with a number of different entities, from parents to business leaders to other local units of government, but unfortunately we have to stand here and raise some concerns about the bill. I'm not going to repeat what you heard this morning, but generally, you know, MASA believes that the school board is elected and accountable by the public. The public has an opportunity to voice their views, and it's reflected by their vote. We feel that this disenfranchises the publics and local communities. We also believe that the school board plays a very important role in choosing a superintendent to lead and transform a community, and if the community is not satisfied with the work that school district is doing, they have the opportunity through their vote, or for instance choosing to run for the school board, to try to change that school board. And then lastly, you know, we heard a lot about stability. MASA would be happy to work with our partners on the School Boards Association to try and provide some more stability to superintendent contracts, to allow for the contracts to be a rolling contract, or allow school boards to have a contract longer than 3 years, 5 years, say. We'd be happy to entertain that, and that would certainly provide some more stability to a school district, especially a school district that's leading some that's trying to lead some big changes. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Dilsland. Are there others in the audience who would like to express concerns? Or even if you're here tonight for the first time, to express support? Then, Representative Kelly, we have some others who have questions. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just sitting here thinking what it was I wanted to say, but one of the things, it reminds me in session today when I heard Representative Cornish make a comment about outside do-gooders coming in trying to, those were his words, it wasn't mine, but it just made me think so much about this here, saying that we can save you, we have the answers for you. In the midst of that, you are leaving a community of people out the process and delegating what should be done to one person. And we're a community of people that is a community that likes to be engaged in that process. And I think, in my mind, at the forefront of this is really our kids and the parents who will be missing a chance to have a voice in this proposal about what the school should look like, what that learning should look like, and how schools can best be supported. So I'm going to stop there because...
Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Verrett.
I will pass, Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kelly, on page 3, we've got the subdivision 6, the exception related to home rule charter. I believe that these are exemptions that mirror the exemptions that we provide to charter schools. I just want to make sure of that. And maybe you can say a little bit more about your thinking behind this, and perhaps we can even ask Ms. Larson to remind us what those exemptions are.
Representative Kelly, do you want to begin or
sure,
wait for Ms.
Chair,
Larson?
Sure, Mariani. I think the thinking was that type of governance is different already from the public model, and I think excusing them from this, that was the general reasoning. Ms. Larson can take over from here.
Ms. Larson, 124 D10 sub 7.
Madam Chair, members, it's a rather cryptic subdivision. If I may, I'll simply read it. It says a charter school is a public school and is part of the state system of public education, period. A charter school is exempt from all statutes and rules applicable to a school, a school board, or a school district unless a statute or rule is made specifically applicable to a charter school or is included in this section.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Representative Mariani, did you have a follow-up?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess it must be late because I'm not understanding what it is that we're specifically trying to accept these new, apparently these new configurations of governing a school district. Are we saying that these school districts can operate in the way that we're permitting charter schools to operate? Is that, I guess that...
Representative Kelly. I'm
not sure what which means.
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, I guess I'm having a little trouble with the question.
Madam Chair, and I apologize. I guess I'm not tracking. Ms. Larson read the language. I'm not sure what it means. Maybe it's a better question, Ms. Larson.
Well, I think that what Ms. Larson read is clear. I think it's the language here that I'm wondering. Ms. Larson, again.
Madam Chair, members, perhaps the idea is to the extent that laws apply to charter schools, the laws apply here, and to the extent that there are statutes and rules not applicable, they would not apply to the extent the non-application would be consistent with implementing the provisions of the section.
Representative Kelly, would you like to further clarify?
Not really, ma'am.
Sounds to me like we have two things going on at the same time. I understand, Representative Mariani.
Be continued, Madam Chair.
Perhaps this subdivision 6, Representative Kelly, when this bill proceeds, if it does,
absolutely,
that you would pay some attention to clarification.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
I know it's an exemption in relation to Home Rule Charter. That has to do with the organization of the city, right, but then the other is confusing. Representative Dabney, question?
Madam Chair, since we're on drafting questions, Representative Kelly, the text on 2.9 through 2.18. I think I understand. It seems to be about the transition from the current elected board to an appointed board. Mm-hmm. And I understand the bill only applies to Minneapolis and St. Paul, but I don't see the Minneapolis School Board reflected in this language, meaning it's, Representative Mariani, apparently only applies to St. Paul.
Oh, goody.
Yeah. Which, you know, you could get my vote yet.
Thanks, pal.
Can you help me to understand that language better and see how it applies to the Minneapolis School Board?
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, I believe as we look at that language, it was used as an example. As we say, in the case of a six-member board, it was used as an example. So I believe it would fit both St. Paul and Minneapolis, and Ms. Larson maybe can expand on that. Does that make sense?
Ms. Larson, do you want to respond to that? I think you've set it up well, though, but go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, with respect to the size of, this is a law of general application, and with respect to the size of school boards, it can be a six-member board or a seven-member board. And I believe that the intent was, in either case, whether it was six or seven, as the re-election of the incumbent, when the incumbent member's terms expired, the mayor is charged with appointing a replacement for the expiring member, for the member whose term is expiring plus one, so that with six you'd still have four. Mm-hmm. and then three, or with seven, you could have either three expire or four expire, but if three were expiring, there would be an additional person appointed. So in either case, the mayor would have a majority of one when replacing the board over a staggered period, because board members are elected board members' elections are staggered.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Then I think where I remain confused, and this is to you then, Ms. Larson, is this creates on lines 2.5 a seven-member board, but in 2.9 through 2.8, it seems to contemplate replacing each member of the elected board with an appointee as the elected board members terminate. But you can't have both. In the case of Minneapolis, this doesn't apply.
Representative Dabney, is Minneapolis a seven-member board?
It's currently an eight-member board.
Eight-member board, ooh.
And if it survives until November, it would be a nine-member board. And so it's creating a seven-member board. Okay, I get that. But then it's contemplating replacing each member as they retire, at which point it doesn't work, as I understand it. Because it seems to be written in a clear and specific way. It's not for example, this is how it would work, that would then apply to Minneapolis.
Ms. Larson. Put your microphone.
And no, I'm not looking to make an amendment.
Madam Chair, members, perhaps part of your question is answered, but perhaps not fully. On 2.18, it talks about when structuring the seven-member board that in the second set of staggered appointments, only three successors would be appointed regardless of the number of terms expiring. And so we may still have to fix it a little bit, but that's meant to get at the excess number.
Madam Chair, in 2008, by over 65% vote, the citizens of Minneapolis chose to reform the governance structure of the school board and adopt the same structure that we have for our separately elected park board. And we're evolving towards the full expression of this, but it moves us from a seven-member board, all elected at large, where we, in fact, Representative Kelly did have the problem that people often didn't know who the school board member was and often didn't feel represented because they had no one in their community that was from there that was also on the board. And so we're in the process of transitioning to six members elected by districts and three elected at large. So people now know their school board member, at least in their district area, because now they've got to go out and door knock. So it's a grassroots up approach, hopefully then building a base of support and engagement with the community on education reform, because it's not then being done to the community, it's being done with, because they have the opportunity to be engaged. And so one of the concerns, a couple of concerns I have about this bill, one is not even 4 years ago, the voters of Minneapolis overwhelmingly said, we want this to be our governance structure. And one of the things I've learned as an elected official is to have an awful lot of respect for my boss, which is every voter in the district. And that when they say, we want to do it this way, I should respect that and give that some time to play out before we pull it up by the roots. But also, it's a philosophical difference about, do you do it grassroots up, increase transparency and increase accountability, or do you do it top down, muddy the transparency, muddy the accountability? Which way do you get a better approach to education reform? And I think you could ask former Mayor Fenty of Washington how that worked for him. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Kelly.
Yes, Madam Chair. I believe, just structurally, Representative Dabney, I believe that we can change that language in Subdivision 4 so that it matches the example type of criteria that we use below. So I think we can fix that to make sure that the language matches. But
Representative Peterson Brandon, did you still have a question you wanted to ask? I had you on the list from this morning.
Oh, from this morning?
Pay attention now. We're in class.
If better be good. Madam Chair, if I have anything to add, I'll
Thank
get
you.
Back on the list.
Thank
here.
You. Is Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is just a question based on what Representative Dabney was talking about with Mayor Ryback. You know, in his email, he talks about his primary concern is that he doesn't believe a change of this scope can be successful if it is imposed on a community without community input. In your discussions with the mayor, is that an opening to say that he would be open to this if there was some sort of mechanism for community input that, you know, we've already said we're not mandating it. We're saying that we're going to allow this to be something they could do. Is that an opening, do you see, from the mayor, or is that just kind of just a statement to say, yeah, if every voter in Minneapolis would say, yes, we do that, we could do that?
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Woodard, I would direct you to the last full paragraph in the email where Mayor Ryback says, I want to repeat my point in the earlier letter, I would welcome an active discussion with legislators, my community, and other interested parties about what more can be done, including more accountability, putting more accountability on my shoulder to address an achievement gap that is at a crisis level. The mayor is very actively engaged in the schools. In many ways, in the community and the schools around youth issues, youth violence issues, youth employment issues, assisting with fundraising, working with grants, foundations for the schools, any number of ways. And he is open to more. He's acutely aware of both the strengths of the Minneapolis schools and the high success that many students experience, as well as the challenges in the achievement gap, and is open to discussions. But in talking with his chief of staff today, as well as with him, this bill imposed from the outside without anyone from Minneapolis who's testified in favor of it, I believe, is accurate, and not coming from the community, I think, means that he is not supportive of this bill.
Representative Woodard?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the clarification, Representative Dabney. I guess he may not quite understand it because it's not really imposed upon the community. It was an idea that if they decided they wanted to do that, they would have the ability to do that. But I understand where you're coming from on that. I had a question along the lines of what Representative Benson was saying earlier about why are we just doing this for St. Paul and Minneapolis, and I've kind of been thinking about that today in that line because I've heard that before. Mm. And one of the things I was thinking is that I would be open to an amendment that says the Belle Plaine School District would have this ability, because as long as it wasn't imposed upon them and it became a tool. The difficulty with that, of course, is that the Belle Plaine School District goes well beyond the boundaries mm-hmm. of what the mayor has authority over. Mm-hmm. When you mention that, Representative Benson, are there other things that you have in mind, other areas you have in mind that would meet that criteria where a mayor might be within the boundaries of a school district, with the exception of Minneapolis and St. Paul?
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, there are a number of suburban school districts that are completely within the boundaries of the city. Edina Schools is almost. There's a small section of Edina which is in the Hopkins School District. But I guess my point in asking these questions was that it just seems to me there's a supposition that somehow the Minneapolis schools, in their attempts to work on this achievement gap problem that we all acknowledge exists, somehow are not able to accomplish what districts such as the one I spent my career in. And I just if we're going to make these kinds of changes, I think they have to be based on some data. And I asked the spokesman for the department whether they had any. Are those? And it's very difficult. We can go all the way back to the arguments about busing and all that kind of thing. And the notion then was, Well, if we have minority students who aren't doing well, we'll send them to these wonderful suburban schools, and somehow middle class values will rub off on them and all these kinds of things. All this social experimentation that was going on, I never felt was worth the misery that it put people through. I always believed in local schools. To me, the problem was, what are we doing about affordable housing and employment and transportation opportunities for people? And I see, you know, as time going on, we now, I think, have a dramatic increase in minority populations moving into the suburbs in Seoul. And so the problem is beginning to ameliorate to some degree, at least. And I just think if we're going to suddenly tell, to me, schools only work if they can be as close to the parents as possible. And parents pick the school board members, and, you know, when you have a democracy, you've got to be willing to accept the fact that people make mistakes sometimes, and, you know, they could do things a little bit better. If you want perfection, then have an autocracy of some kind, have a dictatorship. And the dictator will send all the orders, and we'll all salute, you know, just hope you get a good one, I guess. I don't know if there are any. Frederick the Great maybe was one, but not too many of them floating around. So if we're going to tell Minneapolis that this is something now, that even if it's an option, I noticed the word they. Who's they? Wouldn't it be the mayor? Shouldn't it be he or she decides? I mean, does this bill indicate that the school board or the administration of Minneapolis St. Paul's schools would suddenly appeal to the mayor, Mayor Rybeck, and say, we give up, we're throwing up our hands, and we want you to run it and fire all of us and replace us with somebody who's much more competent? Or I just don't see how this is manageable, and it's all based on a supposition that to me, in my district, we didn't have so many kids who were challenged, and this was a lot easier for us. But I'm not convinced that my district did any better with those children than Minneapolis-St. Paul. I think Minneapolis-St. Paul, from what I observe, are working a heck of a lot harder than most of the suburban school districts are. Not that they're not trying, but it's so much a part of, you know, the issues that they have to deal with in those two cities. So I don't know. It just seems, again, I just have a sense that some of us who live in other communities are sitting out here and telling people who deal with this every day, oh, we know better than you. And that's the whole problem I have with much that goes on in this legislature, putting out requirements and mandates, and usually without any money, because we all think we know better. And we're kind of generalists. Many people haven't even been in the school system and never worked with kids who were challenged. I didn't too much. I got all the cushy jobs, you know, like Representative Kath over there. I got to teach the advanced placement stuff. Okay. And when they all did, yeah, cushy. And when we were all, you know, and when they were doing well, I got to take all the credit, you know, and I didn't even have to mention that they have parents who were, you know, giving them all these opportunities and all the rest of the things that were going on. So I didn't want to go on too long, but that's enough. I just think it's...
Representative Peterson Brandon. Thank you, Representative Benson.
Madam Chair, can I just have a quick closing statement?
It's not
even a question of Representative Dabney or Representative Benson.
Representative Woodard.
To hit on why all of these things are being brought up and why we're discussing these ideas. I mean, I think the mayor had it right on the head. You know, you pointed me to the last paragraph there. He says that it's at a crisis level. Mm-hmm. We heard, you know, in that the opinion article that I mentioned this morning, where the governor made some comments that he believes the Minneapolis School District is in serious trouble. So that's why these ideas are coming up, why we're discussing them, and why we're talking about them maybe instead of the Edina School District, because we, you know, there's this recognition that something needs to happen, and that's why we're exploring these ideas. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson Brandon, last question. Oh, Marianne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's not really a question, I guess, but just looking at the email, if this email were in fact true and did accurately describe what we're proposing here, I would agree with it. Unfortunately, it doesn't. it says that we are imposing this upon a community. And correct me if I'm wrong, and I may be looking at this in a very simplistic manner, but today, Minneapolis School District governance structure exists, and that's it. That's the only option. We're going to move forward with that unless they change themselves. And let's just say tonight this became effective. They still have that option tomorrow, mm-hmm. as well as another option, and they can choose to do that. So this doesn't close options, and this doesn't suggest that one party knows more than they do. It, in fact, says, you know so much, you could even do something else. So, you know, and I think on another topic, and this is what I wanted to touch on earlier, there's a lot of research around taking a more holistic approach to communities that are disadvantaged, even stepping outside of the classroom and looking at some of these other factors that impact education. The Center for Teacher Quality has a project called Teaching 2030, and they jump into a concept called teacherpreneur, and this is someone who has the ability to be a career advisor and has the ability to even leave the school environment and go to the home and address other areas. And you know, these are revolutionary concepts that may well work in these disadvantaged communities. And I see, and the reason I signed on to the bill, number one, is I wanted to see it get a hearing and I wanted to have this discussion. And what we haven't really got to is the part that I'm most interested in, and that is how can the mayor's office leverage all of the tools at his disposal outside of the school environment to take a more holistic approach at these issues. And I think, you know, while we focused a lot on the negative side of this, the mayor's office can do that. And the mayor's office has the ability to reach into the community and affect a lot of these ancillary issues. And if that's where we're moving to, and if we all agree that environmental issues outside of the classroom have an impact, this may well be a vehicle. And it's an option, but it may well be the vehicle to make that kind of change. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani, last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kelly, on line 2.29, this is under the powers and duties of the Board of Education that would include, and you have a list of, I don't know, looks like eight duties. And we could spend a lot of time actually talking about all of these and probably should, but we won't. But on line 2.29, it says reducing the cost of non-educational services, and then goes on to say and implementing cost-saving measures. So I have a couple of very quick questions. What are non-educational services?
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, I guess I would take those to mean things other outside the classroom. I mean operations of the district, things that don't pertain to actual classroom structure.
So then,
Representative Mariani,
Madam Chair, so the goal would be that those outside the classroom services the goal that this board would be shooting for would be to reduce those costs. So fair enough. You know, it seems to me I'm not an expert, but it seems to me that for us to attack what we're all calling the achievement gap, that we need to understand what drives it. And I think part of what, that concerns me, and it isn't just this bill, it's all sorts of other bills, and I've probably been involved in some of the others myself, is I think we make some pretty broad assumptions about what the root causes are of the achievement gap, and then offer solutions to that. This one implies that those non-classroom services have perhaps little or nothing to do with what may be undermining the achievement gap. We know that the Harlem Children's Zone, I think, you know, all of us on both sides of the aisle have admired the work that Jeffrey Canada has done over in New York City. But if Mr. Canada was here, I suspect that he would say is that if you want to address the achievement gap, the last thing you need to do is distance yourself from the non-educational services issue. And in fact, I think what he would argue is that What you need to do is to find a way in which to create some synergy and collaboration across a number of things that we do as a people that involve both inside the classroom and outside the classroom type of work. Right now in Minneapolis and St. Paul, both of those school districts are involved with the mayors of those school districts in exploring a collaborative model called the STRIVE model. It's based out of originally Cincinnati, and apparently there are several other cities across the nation that are pushing, have created new ways in which jurisdictions, so the mayor's office, school districts, but also the private sector, faith communities, can enter into binding collaborative agreements with one another based on student data analysis and sharing analysis and quickly getting into intervention modes. And so it seems to me that two things. One is that I don't argue that the mayor doesn't have, in a big city, the ability to command resources. And I also don't argue that the mayor in those places should not be involved in K-12 education. The STRIVE model suggests to us that there's a way in which we can powerfully do that without having the mayor run the school itself. And so that's one point, but the other point, Madam Chair, I'll stop because I got to get to my son's basketball game. But Representative Kelly, I would urge you to revisit the language on 2.29 relative to non-educational services in all sincerity, because I think that flies against the building knowledge out there about what it's going to take to address the achievement gap. And I think the evidence tells us that only focusing in on classroom activities is not going to get that done.
Representative Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, certainly appreciate that input. I think one of the main reasons that's there, though, is because we still need the district to be financially sound, and I think that's more what it's aiming at, because I think, we started this discussion hours ago in regards to the teacher strike in 1946 when, some of the main issues were they were dealing with a $30 a day per diem cap in St. Paul. They were dealing with some schools that didn't have bathroom facilities.
Right.
So, that part of it about being, we have to be financially sound and structurally sound in order for us to concentrate on what's the educational side, certainly. So I understand what you're saying, where the emphasis needs to be, but I think it can't be there unless we are financially sound. So that's the way I would look at it, but certainly take your advice and input, and we'll look at that.
Representative Kelly, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee. You've been very gracious with your time, and certainly appreciate all of it, and appreciate the testifiers that came down. A couple of comments by Representative Benson. We talk about why are we looking at this? Maybe Representative Moran quoted Representative Cornish and said these outsider do-gooders. I don't look at it that way. We're charged with a duty here. I think we are all on the same team. When we look at just the numbers, Minneapolis and St. Paul, Representative Benson, we spend a majority of the education dollars there. So I would say just by that token alone, we owe it to Minneapolis and St. Paul to look at them. And when we start talking about data, many of the testifiers paraded through here and they said there's just no statistical proven data that says that mayoral control will solve this. Well, I would suggest to anyone who came through there, though, show me the statistical data that says that over the years that we've been looking at data and the data that comes out that says we're 20% less proficient in math, science, and reading, where is the data to suggest that the school board control or elections that we have now is working? So this was, and Representative Woodard and Representative Peterson, spoke to it very eloquently. This is not a mandate. This is to suggest we want the community involved. We want another tool in the toolbox for these mayors.
I think we've got, as we said, a great conversations with the school board chair of St. Paul, and they're doing great things. If I was the mayor, I would, and they are very engaged, I would say I want the stability to keep this going. I want this. We're on a great path, and I think I want to solidify this, and I want to lock it in place. Mayor Rybak, at this point, as he said, he would love to be engaged and to have a conversation. Well, we're giving him the opportunity to do that. He does not have to do this. Mayor Coleman does not have to do this. He should engage the community. He should say, do you think we are on the right path with where we're going? And if the community says, absolutely, we are on the right path and we want to continue and this is our governing model because we said so 4 years ago, then that's fine. But if there is another way out there, and as we looked at page upon page of qualitative data and statistical data, it kept coming back to increased stability, increased funding, more philanthropic dollars into the community and into the school district. And I'll just leave you with the last conclusion that they came up with. They said, the statistical significance of strong mayoral involvement with achievement scores at some levels and in some areas suggests that mayoral involvement, if not control, should at the very least be considered as part of an overall district improvement strategy. And so that's what we're here today to give you. To say, here is a tool that if you look at the data and you see for the last 20, 30, 40 years, we keep doing something over and over and we're just not getting the results we wanted, maybe we need another look. And that's what I'm bringing here to you today, and I appreciate your indulgence and your time. So I would appreciate your support on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 2621, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to government operations. Thank you very much, Representative Kelly, and thank you, members.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Representative Loon, House File 2580. Welcome to our committee, Representative Loon. I will move House File 2580 to be before the committee, recommended to pass, and be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance, and I believe you have an amendment.
I do, Madam Chair.
I'll move the DE1 amendment for Representative Loon. Representative Loon, will you explain the DE1 amendment, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I thank the committee. The DE1 amendment puts a little more meat on the bones of the bill as originally introduced. And I'll just highlight a few of the changes from the original introduction. One with regards to parents submitting a petition, we made it clear that it must be a majority of parents. We said most, but we included the 51% just to make it clear that it was a majority of the parents. We said most, but we included the 51% just to make it clear that it was a majority of the parents. With regards to the intervention models that parents could petition their school board for, specifically with regards to the restart model, where parents could petition to have their school closed and restarted under a charter operation, I added language in there that indicated that option would be available only for a charter school operator, management organization, or educational management organization operating a charter in which they have shown in a other charter school that they operate they are exceeding state proficiency and growth standards on state reading and math assessments in at least the preceding 3 years. And the goal of that was to indicate that a replacement of a school with a new model would have to be with something that's got a proven track record of success. And that's one of the changes. I think the petition portion of that is largely the same as was in the original draft. And there are some timelines incorporated into the steps along the process. So the school district, the school board, as they're looking at that, is given some guidelines on how much time they have to verify the petition is being valid, to notify and establish a public hearing, to take public comment on the petition and the parent requested intervention, and then for their further action on that. And I think that's essentially the changes in the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Members, with her amendment before us, so she can have the bill in the order that she would like, I will again renew that we amend 2580 with the DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the bill is in the order in which Representative Loon would like it. Is there anything else further that you want to say before we hear from testifiers? Because I think your DE1 amendment is the bill, so.
It is, Madam Chair, and I think, you know, in the interest of time,
yes.
We have some testifiers that were here this morning and have come back, so I would like to respect their time and allow them to go first, if that pleases the Chair.
So please come down if you are here to testify for Representative Loon in support of 2580. Welcome to our committee. Yes, pull up additional chairs, please. Speak your name into the microphone, please.
Good evening. My name is Randy Prunchinski.
And please begin your testimony.
Good evening, Chair, committee members. My name is Randy Prunchinski, and I'm here today in support of HF 2580. For the past 16 years, I've been a resident of Lakeville and extremely active in our schools. And right now, I bet you're all thinking about, why is somebody from Lakeville here to talk on this bill? They got great schools, and we do. But I'm also a former resident of Southern California, where I married into a family of teachers that worked in the school system. I know firsthand how an underperforming school can negatively impact not only our students, but literally the entire community. My wife and I lived in California community where she grew up, went to school, and where her parents were both teachers. Her parents moved there because it was a nice city with great schools, and they just had a brand new high school, which is basically the same reasons I moved here to Lakeville. As our California community changed and the school started to fall behind, the bureaucracy of the system made it impossible for us parents, or even my in-laws who worked there, to make a difference. When our children were born, my in-laws encouraged me to make sure that we could get them into a private school because the schools weren't going to be able to save themselves in California. We were active in the community and attempt to get involved, but we had no power to make change. We decided, finally, we'll just give up and put our son in private school. The sad part about this is, in California, that happened in one short generation in my wife's lifetime as a school student. I do not want to see this for Lakeville schools or any other Minnesota schools to go down this path or watch another community feel as we did and have no voice. I can tell you that Lakeville community parents already tell us there's nothing we can do. The district won't listen to us, and nothing's ever going to change. I've heard this before, and I watched the community fall into shambles. As a parent, I can tell you there's nothing that hurts me more than to know that I can't help my child when he or she needs it. Not all parents are as lucky as we are. They're not able to move to a new district, or in our case, a new state. When their schools begin to fail, all they can hope for is that they can get their kids through before it's unbearable. I encourage you to give parents the opportunity to take a more active role in the education of our children by voting for this simple reform. We parents are willing to help to make our schools better. All we're asking is for the tools to make this happen. So please support HF 2580 and watch what we'll do for our kids. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Hi, my name is John Carlson. I'm here today not only as a member of Students First, but also as a parent of a school-aged child. I'm here today to encourage you to pass HF 2580. This bill makes it easier for parents to help out should their child's school start to slip academically. I think we can all agree that no one wants to send their kids to a bad school. And we can also agree that the state's budget simply won't allow the state to spend all the money that would be necessary to bring every school up to the level of the best schools. What we need is ingenuity, and this bill provides just that. It simply says that if a school starts to go bad, parents have the ability to form an organization that will step in and help get it back on track. It doesn't require an endless supply of money. It doesn't create a new layer of bureaucratic red tape to an already unsettling problem. All it does is it allows parents to step up and take a more active role in the education of their own children. We can all agree that parental involvement makes schools better. By increasing the opportunities for parental involvement, this bill will make all schools better at no cost to the state. I don't know why any legislator, especially one on the Education Reform Committee, would vote against this. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Will you stick around if you can for questions? Are there others in the audience who would like to testify to this bill in support of it? Then we'll move to those with concerns. Thank you, gentlemen. If you just stay up there in the audience, we'll call you down if we have some questions. Those with concerns, please. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jim Grafall. I represent the Minneapolis schools, and we had a very rich conversation with Representative Loon about the bill, and I just wanted to give a perspective. When we begin to adapt legislation from other states, we have to recognize we have different conditions here. So on the bill, I just have two things to address, and one is the approximate academic year. We really don't have an easy bake oven where we can turn and pivot and create a charter school option in about an hour. So if we get a petition in May, or even if we get a petition in October, the approximate year may be a difficult issue. It takes a year of planning in our experience to get that, and we've just gone into a multi-year partnership with Eric Mahmoud at Harvest Prep. So, I mean, we have experience working the charter side of the ledger. I just want to bring that to your attention. Second, a school board is not required to implement the intervention or other governance arrangements. This language, the lines 4.8 to 4.9, we had a discussion about, in our experience in Minneapolis working turnaround schools, the first thing that happens is the parents want to protect their principal, want to protect the teachers. Our experience is where the board's leaning forward and saying your data is this, we need change, we're going to implement these turnaround models that we discuss in the bill. So we spoke with Representative Loon about, we want to make sure that the petition isn't used to prevent a school board and a school administration from implementing the turnaround model. I think this language is in here to address that. In the back of the room, we talk amongst ourselves. There's some concern among the witnesses that may follow that this may not address that particular issue. But I just thought, put that in front of you, that if you've got a school board and a school administration working the reform agenda, working the turnaround model, I think we'd all agree we shouldn't have the petition be a way to put a spoke in that wheel of change. Sorry for that loud noise. That's my emphatic conclusion, then. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Grafall.
Thank you.
Ms. Kelleher? Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. I'd like to thank Representative Loon. She reached out weeks ago and has slowly taken in our input model and has always been pleasant and open to change. And though I hate to be on this side of the dime with her, she is exceptional to work with and is very open to listening to our concerns. I'd like to say my first concern was something I dreamed up, or as I read the bill, it came to me. It actually came from a memo Ms. Larson wrote about the SIG schools. And her concern, and it really expressed MSBA's concern, that these solution models have the inherent problem of being not equally available around the state or appropriate to have all the school management options around the state. So what might be easy to be available here in the metro area is not what you're going to find out in Black Duck. So if you just choose the school closure model and that's your high school in Lake of the Woods, it's going to be an issue to where your kids go or whether you even have a viable high school to be a school district anymore. So we think there's some bigger issues to talk about how we want to go forward across the state. We also are concerned that how this would interfere with ongoing federal, state, or NCLB waivers. So if we're actually starting the process to change and we're in year one or two, if we had parents who got together and did this, you know, is there some protection when we start down that path? There's some inherent process concerns about the election process in this bill. How would you count 51% of your voters if you're looking at the parents that come into your high school? How would that be counted? Who would know the number? How would you know if you got to 51%? Also, normally when we have petition requests, the county auditors look at that data and verify that. That's not something unnormal for school districts to do. And it talks about the parent can represent one child. But if you have three children, do you get to go twice? And then is that a duplicate? And how do you want us to count those? And last but not least, MSBA truly supports parents because we know they're pivotal in children's success. And I don't want you to think any of these concerns go to how we know that we need parents in the classroom. But Minnesota can be very proud we offer a strong choice environment. And we'd like to suggest that it would be easier to be elected to the school board and get a majority there than going through this process. And we want to encourage parents across the state to run for your local school board. So thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Welcome, Mr. Aronson. Please say your name for the record
and
begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members and Representative Loon. I'm Roger Aronson. I represent the Elementary and Secondary Principals Associations. The message of this bill, I think, is different than what the bill does. And the message of this bill is that everyone should explore every option available to attempt to improve low-performing schools. That's what this message is. That's not a new message. That message has come from the feds. That message has come from this committee. And we've talked about that a lot. The manner in which that message gets conveyed in this bill is very problematic. Mr. Grathwall referenced one of these. That was a very real deal. When we talked about implementing the turnaround school models on the federal levels where it was mandated that you fired your principal, there were several school districts that didn't want to do that. They had a lot invested in this individual, and they thought that individual could make a significant difference in directing that school. Assume that's true in a particular case. If you adopt this model and you implement one of those turnaround strategies that's involved in the petition here, you'd be locked into that. You don't have any flexibility. There's nothing that is delicate or thoughtful about this. It's actually rather rigid. And you know, as lawyers and as lobbyists very often, our eye to look on these is assuming everyone behaves badly and the worst happens under these documents. You know, and that is how we do the analysis. But part of this says, if I'm in my school and it's making some efforts, but a neighboring charter thinks that we have some growth potential as a takeover piece, they could get the petition drive started, and suddenly our school, even if there's a large number of parents that don't want to move to that charter, could find themselves moving to that charter because of this petition model, I believe, as this is set up. There are some other pieces on that, and are that going to happen? Is everyone going to behave badly? Who knows? But you need a lot of flexibility for the department to monitor these things. You need good school board people to be looking at intervention strategies that make sense. And we think this one is too rigid in the way that it implements that. Finally, I might say that Mr. Grathwall referenced the language that's on 4.8 in the end. And I know that other members of the lobbying community that I've worked with have visited with Representative Loon about what that language means. And that language says that you don't have to implement this if the petition request is inconsistent with this section. I mean, I read that and I think, well, of course that's true. You only have to implement it if people comply with that section. I'm not sure what that means. I don't think that if it's intended to provide us some protection, I don't know that it does provide us any protection. So when you come back to this, I think that the idea of exploring every option about working on schools and restarting them is something that we're all committed to do. I think that there is some risk in implementing this rigid process. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Aronson.
Thank you.
Are there others in the audience? Welcome, Department. Please say your name for the record. Begin.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members. My name is Darren Cordy. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Education. First of all, I want to thank Representative Loon for bringing this bill forward. As you know, the department, as other testifiers have said, you know, we're always in favor of getting parental input when it comes to decision-making around schools and getting parents more involved. So we definitely applaud the intent behind this bill. There were just some issues that we did have with the bill. The first was just it's unclear in our eyes under paragraph A which schools this would apply to. Obviously, we're talking about the SIG program, and then it says schools that continue to not make adequate yearly progress. So we kind of read that to be the new priority schools under the waiver, under the NCLB waiver. But effectively, I guess it would be all priority schools, since SIG schools under the waiver will automatically be priority schools. So given that's the case, we do find that these four models could be problematic. The general concern that we have is under the waiver, and we'll be providing districts more flexibility to come up with customized solutions to address issues that are going on with their school on a school-by-school basis. This bill takes away some of that flexibility and poses certain one-size-fits-all strategies in the turnaround models. So we feel that what's going to be happening with priority schools under the waiver is already going to kind of address what the concerns under this bill are, and that it is going to be a more flexible process than what would be provided under this bill. The other question we had was in, I believe it's paragraph G of section 1, there's a limit of 20 schools per year that would be able to exercise this. We're just kind of unclear whether or not that would create sort of a race situation between parents and groups at different priority schools to see who can get in first under this. So it might not actually be something where we're handling schools that need the most help. It's just which parents can get mobilized quicker. Secondly, in the case of the SIG schools, the school improvement grant schools have already gone through the types of interventions that are described in this bill. So it's unclear whether or not if the parent trigger were to go forth, would they have to go through these again? Under the third option on page 2, it states school closure model requiring the district is located to close the school and transfer students enrolled in the school to another high achieving school in the district. High achieving school isn't defined under that section. We assume the intention would be to have them be reward schools as are classified under the waiver. And that's fine, but the reality is that there's going to be very few districts where there are priority schools and reward schools in the same district. And option 4 is basically what's going to be the transformational model. It's what's going to be required of priority schools under the waiver. So to some extent, this model is already going to be taking place for these priority schools. So those are just some of the concerns that we have surrounding this bill. And with that, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Corte. Are there others? The business partnership wanted me to call attention to the letter they submitted, written to Representative Loon and signed by Charlie Weaver. So members, that is their support. Are there any others in the audience? Then we'll begin with questions. Representative Kath.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Loon. A lot of the concerns or the questions that I had have already been brought out there, but one is that, so is your assumption then that at the beginning of creating a petition that they would choose the restructuring model and then the parents would sign off on that, or is it once they get enough signatures and they decide which intervention model they would like?
Representative Loon.
Representative Kath, no, the parents would have to, the petition would have to be circulated with a specific intervention model as part of the petition.
Representative Kath.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And so, like, let's say they chose intervention number 3 and the petition starts, what if there isn't another high-achieving school in the district?
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Kapp. Well, I think that's an interesting point to bring up, but I just have to say, as a parent who's got kids in public school, I think you have to give parents a little credit for knowing a little bit about what's in their district, and if they're in a rural area and there's no other school there, I can't imagine signing a petition saying that you want your child's school closed and then transfer to a school in the district when there isn't one. So I can't imagine a parent selecting an option that really isn't available in their district.
Representative Kath.
Madam Chair, I didn't mean it that way. I'm just saying, what would a high-achieving school be considered then? I mean, what if in the time that they started this petition that another school district would have been placed on AYP in one section, whether it be the number of students tested or things like that? I guess, what would your timeline, because it seems like it would be within a approximate year. You know, I guess I'm wondering how their hands are going to be tied with this, of saying that once you choose that model, how would it be implemented if it's actually not possible? And that's more of a comment, but another question that I would have then is, would this actually then create that every school district, or is it your intention, because on page 4, would every school district then become a charter authorizer? Because of the fact that you would be required to convert every school that way under one of these reform models.
Representative Loon.
I'm not sure I'm clear on your question, because you wouldn't be required to convert all schools to a charter. It would just be if it's the one school that has been the subject of the parent petition, and if that's the option that the parents are seeking. Again, the school board is given latitude in the legislation to choose another governance model. But again, they would have to be the subject of public hearing and debate and that by the board. And I think if you have a majority of parents taking the time and effort to come en masse to their school board and say, what is happening in our school is not working for our children, and we've all gotten together and decided we think this would be better than what we have, and that's a serious discussion that I think the board needs to pay attention to.
One follow-up?
Representative Kath.
Where is there in here where they can choose a different model, the school board? Can you? So in other words, if they see that one of the options that they put in there, I guess I did not see that in here.
Representative Loom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. Well, in line 4.8, a school board is not required to implement the intervention or other governance arrangement requested by parents if it's inconsistent. And also on the first page, line 1.19, well, it starts on the preceding line, but the board must implement the parent-requested intervention model or other governance arrangement. So there is quite a bit of flexibility allowed for the school boards in this petition law.
Madam Chair.
Senator Kath.
So other governance arrangement, would you say that it could be something than the other three that would have been listed here, or what kind of latitude are you saying for the other governance arrangement?
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kath. Well, it could certainly be one of the other three, but I would also envision this doesn't limit them to only that, is the wording under the proposal as it stands. So if there was some other model, I don't, you know, perhaps the school board had been looking at something else and they want to present that to the parents, and this provides them again a very public forum to have that discussion with those parents.
Representative Daphne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a couple of the questions have been answered, but I'm still a little perplexed about a couple of things here. And maybe I'll just go through, follow the process of the bill. The language that was already discussed on 2.5 through 2.7 about being able to petition to close the school and transfer the students elsewhere. So my kids are at Lincoln Elementary, and Washington Elementary is better. So we petition, including parents whose kids don't attend Lincoln Elementary, consign, to close Lincoln and transfer everybody to Washington. What if there isn't capacity at Washington? There's just not enough room.
Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Dabney. Yes, that is a possible, likely scenario, and I think, again, then you're going to have the board have that discussion with parents and perhaps also with leaders of the other school and indicate to them, you know, under open enrollment there would be X amount of spots, and have that frank discussion with parents about whether or not that's a viable option.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 2.26, the language on the petition. One attends a school that normally matriculates into the school that is subject to the petition. So my children attend a K-8. But there are middle schools, 6 through 8 middle schools, that they could also attend. So as a parent, if some group of adults wanted to repurpose the middle school that my child could attend, that would be a normal option for them. But I have them in a K-8, and my personal intent is to keep them in that K-8. Would I also not qualify to sign the petition to repurpose a school that I have no intention of sending my children to because they could normally matriculate into that school?
Representative Bloom.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I think under your scenario, because you have your children enrolled in a K-8 school, it would be my assumption that your intent would be to have them complete their education through 8th grade in that school. And so I would not interpret that situation as having you be a parent eligible to sign the petition. But I think you raise an interesting point, and there's a couple of things, a few things throughout this bill that I do intend to continue to refine. And some of the definitions that have been raised, I think it could be subject to some interpretation, and we need to specify those. And that may be one of those areas where we need to specify.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Representative.
Representative Loon, I'm trying to understand the verification of signature process, 3.16 through 3.19. I'm only aware of one situation in the country where this parent trigger law has been used, and it's suburban Los Angeles. I'm not familiar with, obviously, with the schools of the district. What I am familiar with is that the petitioners received more than sufficient number of petition signatures to meet the threshold. I assume it was 51%. I don't know that. And the school board just refused the petition because enough people came forward and said, I was lied to. Their words, not mine. I was lied to when I was asked to sign the petition, or I was misled. It strikes me as a fine distinction that I'm not, you know, ever clear on if you're misleading me or lying to me, which is the difference. But when I look at the language, I guess the clarification I need in your language here is, are they limited to random sampling? We're going to grab these 5 signatures here on the petition and verify them, and then we're going to grab 5 later on and 5 later on, so that you could get to fraud and the like. My wife and I both signing the petition because she got it at one place and I got it presented to me at another, which doesn't seem to comply with the language of your bill. Are they limited to just random sampling, or could they go through and check the veracity of each signature?
Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Dabney, no, under the wording of the bill or through the DE1 amendment, they are not limited. It says they may use random sampling, and it doesn't provide a limitation on how the board would go about verifying those signatures. If they wanted to verify every one, they could. Again, we do set a timeline in the process so that the petition cannot be presented and, you know, a year or two goes by until it is verified. But they certainly could do that.
Representative Duffy.
Madam Chair, two questions that occur to me as we think more about this petitioning process. In order to sign a petition, would I need to provide government-issued ID? And number two, would I need to establish that I was a citizen of the country? Or a citizen, or if I was not a citizen but was here as an I'm sorry, my vocabulary is missing, but here legally,
But not a citizen and eligible to vote. And if I was not here, if I was here in an undocumented status, would my signature be legitimate?
Representative Loon.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, no, you would not have to provide any ID. The verification that the school board is looking for is that you are indeed a parent of a child, mm-hmm. in that school, or a parent of a child that goes to a school in that district that could matriculate into the school that's the subject of the petition.
And, Madam Chair, Representative Loon, so my status in reference to eligibility to vote is not an issue here.
Representative Loon.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, no, it is not.
And my last question, Madam Chair, and I thank you. Representative Loon, I still need you to go over the question that Representative Kath raised on 4-1 and 4-2. It seems like this automatically makes every school district in the state a charter authorizer without requiring them to go through any of the processes to establish that, A, they want to be a charter authorizer, and, B, that they meet what all the qualifications are in statute to be a charter authorizer. Because you say they have to implement converting the school to a charter school, at which point they're a charter authorizer, even if they bring in a charter management organization to operate the school. Can you help me with, I know you answered this with Representative Kath, but I need you to do it again.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney, I think what you're asking me is if the school would not have to go through the normal process of being a charter operator, if that was their choice and they were converting to a charter school, am I getting the question correct?
There are standards in state law that organizations need to meet in order to be certified, I don't know what the language is, by the department as a charter authorizer, at which point then they can engage the process, they can hire a charter management organization. But there's, I believe, 16 in the state, and this would increase that to somewhere in the neighborhood of 370-some charter authorizers. But 356 or whatever of them wouldn't have to go through any qualifications except for the handful of school districts that have already applied and been accepted as charter authorizers. So I'm trying to understand the rationale for two different standards for becoming a charter authorizer.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Dabney. Well, I think I would refer you back to looking at the bottom of page 1.26 through 2.4 on the next page, which kind of covers the option of what we call the restart model, which indicates there if parents are petitioning for this particular type of intervention, it would basically asking the school to close and reopen under the management of a charter school operator, management organization, or educational management organization that currently operates a charter school. And I have added additional qualifications to that they must be operating a charter school somewhere else that is demonstrating through their efforts that they're exceeding state proficiency and growth standards on state reading and math assessments for at least the three preceding years in that charter school. So I'm trying to draw some parameters around that particular option, if you will.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Loon.
Representative Loon, Representative Woodard can give us some guidance here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe. I guess what I liked about the wording is that on 4.3 it says consistent with section 124D-10 or .10, which is the charter school provision, and it does talk about the requirements for authorizers. And so I would assume at that point, and maybe Ms. Larson can correct me if I'm wrong, that you would have to follow within 124D-10, which includes the authorizer language and how you become an authorizer and how a charter school can operate with an authorizer.
Representative Depke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Loon, this is a question for either you or the department. How many public schools do we currently have that have been identified by the department as one of the state's persistently lowest performing schools under the Federal School Improvement Grant Program or the Federal Elementary and Secondary Education Act? And approximately how many students are currently attending and consistently attending those lowest performing schools?
Well, Representative Depke, we have our trusty gentleman from the department here, Mr. Carte.
Madam Chair, members, I believe that there were 32 original persistently low-performing schools that were identified under the SIG program, and from that, there are still 19 that are under the School Improvement Grants Program. As far as the second part of, the definition under A, or the eligibility requirements under paragraph A. As I testified earlier, we were a little unclear as to what schools would fall under the classification of that continue to not make adequate yearly progress. You know, how long would it have to go on, I guess. But we just kind of saw it as the priority schools that would be classified under the new waiver, which would be 5% of the lowest performing 5% of schools receiving Title I dollars. And as far as the actual number of that, I don't have a number.
Approximate is fine.
I think it's like 130.
130 schools or 130 schools. Students?
No, schools.
Oh, 130 schools.
Correct.
And approximately how many students?
Madam Chair, Representative Depke, that's something I would have to get back to you on. I don't know.
And do we know the location of those schools?
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Depke, that list has not been assembled yet.
Right. And would we have that available to us at a later date?
Mr. Corte.
Madam Chair, Representative Depke, I believe the intention by our accountability folks was that in May we expected to have that list up.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Thank
well,
you.
Now we know the scope of the current problem, which I think, quite frankly, is significant.
Is there anyone else who has a question? Closing comments, Representative Lone.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I feel like I'm doing this a little bit backwards, and I know it's getting late of hours, so I'll try to be very brief, but I just wanted to make a couple of points to the committee. And I want to also thank the testifiers, and especially, well, the parents that came and came back tonight to testify, yeah. But also for the folks that expressed some concerns. And I did meet with both Minneapolis and St. Paul Public Schools. The chair of the school board of St. Paul Public Schools came and met with me yesterday, and we had very good discussions. And I want to convey also the spirit of that to the committee with regards to understanding the turnaround models that are being implemented in those two particular school districts. And again, this is not limited to Minneapolis and St. Paul. This would apply anywhere. But I understand that they have a difficult job, and we had a nice conversation about that. And what I'm trying to accomplish with this bill, and whether the wording of it gets there right now or not, I think we could debate, and I do want to continue to make some changes when we go to next committee, if that happens, but is to provide some kind of mechanism for parents to have a formal way of registering their concerns and their desire for change if their children are in a persistently low-performing school. And it really is to give parents a collective voice in some formalized way to present that to the board and to ask them to take action on this. And maybe they decide to do something different. But, you know, we have school board meetings. Most of them have public comment, or perhaps all of them do. But, again, there isn't really anything in law that provides parents that avenue. And it gives voice to parents to do that. And so just as teachers and principals are able to form unions and sort of collectively express their desires and work collectively for their interests, I wanted to give some mechanism for parents to do that in those very lowest performing schools. I think this would be incredibly rare that parents would go to this length. I noticed in Minneapolis Public Schools, they presented me a very nice report on their academic progress, and I met with their turnaround specialist. And they do a survey of their parents. And one of the things that's expressed in a little note below it is that it's a parent satisfaction, but only 23% of their parents are participating in that. So you've got to have parents who are really engaged, really fired up, and all coalesce around a solution that they want to present to a board. That's a very high hurdle for parents to achieve, to even get to the point presenting a petition to the board. So I think it's worth noting that this is rare, but if it is utilized, it would be clear if I was on a board that there was an undeniable lack of confidence and support in the current governance of their child's school, and that something needs to be done. And this is really just a call for action and a way for parents to express that. So, again, I think the department pointed out, and others, maybe a couple of definitional things that we need to do. One thing that I omitted from this accidentally, it wasn't a prior draft, was that if a school is subject to a petition and an intervention model was implemented, that school would not be available for a subsequent petition for at least 3 years, because we do not want to churn through turnaround models in schools. And again, this was the subject also of some discussion with Minneapolis and St. Paul when we talked about it. These things do take some time. Now, we can argue about how much time, because in the life of perhaps your children, Representative Davidi, or anyone else, if you're in elementary school, 3 years out of our schools have just gone to a K-6 model. 3 years out of a K-6 is a lot of time. Yes. In a child's educational life. So, but anyway, I just wanted to point that out. That's something I will be adding to the bill. So, again, I just wanted to kind of outline my overall hope with this. And we could continue to discuss details. But I think it is important, as the department's working on their waiver, and as we heard in the hearing that the Joint Reform and Finance Committee had on that, they do intend for a very specific outreach to parents on their views on the turnaround models they're trying to implement. And some of the same concerns that would be raised about this are also very valid when you talk about implementing that waiver and during turnarounds. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
You know, how do you replace an effective principal? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you give more latitude to really make changes in what's happening? And I talked about some of those specifics, again, with the folks from Minneapolis and St. Paul that came in to talk to me, and some of the struggles that they have in making those really difficult changes in the status quo. So, with that, I thank the committee very much for their attention and listening and for your very good questions about this.
Thank you so much, Representative Luna. You did an excellent presentation. With that, members, I'll renew my motion that 2580, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails. And 2580, as amended, is on its way to education finance. Members, thank you so much for enduring tonight and being just excellent at discussion. This meeting is adjourned.